sprinkle the magic. The darker the truth.
It was all based on a lie.
It was unbelievable.
A mother and daughter running this charity. Was Megan really sick?
The story doesn't add up.
The mother of all cons.
I had no idea where it would all lead.
Starts today on BBC iPlayer.
BBC News at 6 o'clock on Sunday the 31st of May. This is Charles Carroll. Good morning. French police have arrested more than 400 people across the country after violence broke out during Paris Saint-Germain's Champions League final win against Arsenal. The majority of the arrests were in Paris, where around 100,000 people will gather later today near the Eiffel Tower for the team's trophy parade. Adam Gocher has this report.
And Paris Saint-Germain!
Sustained success on the pitch. Continued chaos off it. For the second year in a row, Paris Saint-Germain have won European football's biggest prize. And for the second year in a row, fans have clashed with police across the country. More than 400 arrests in total, over half of them in the French capital. Footage from Paris shows flares being set off, electric bikes burning on the road, and the French Interior Minister Laurent Nunez said 7 officers had been injured. Last year, 2 people, including a 17-year-old boy, died. PSG stars will be hosted by President Macron this afternoon, but not before a greeting by an estimated 100,000 supporters at the Champ de Mars, the scene of last night's unrest, which has again threatened to overshadow the club's historic victory.
Health officials in Brazil say they've identified a suspected case of Ebola. If confirmed, it would be the first infection outside Africa since the current outbreak began in the Democratic Republic of Congo. The man, who's in his 30s, had recently returned from a trip to the DRC. He's being kept in isolation. Reports in US media say President Trump has made amendments to the latest draft of a proposed preliminary deal with Iran. Officials have told the New York Times Mr. Trump wants to reinforce elements, including those covering Tehran's nuclear program. From Jerusalem, here's our correspondent Sebastian Usher.
After anticipation once again rose in the past couple of days that a deal between the US and Iran was about to be closed, the latest reports in the US media suggest that momentum has once again ebbed. Official sources have told reporters that President Trump has hardened the terms of the agreement from the US side and a new framework has now been sent back to Iran. That suggests there could be days or even weeks of more negotiations before a final decision is made by either side to sign up to any deal. In the vacuum, Israel and Hezbollah have continued to descend into deeper conflict. The Israeli military has just said that it's expanding its ground operations in South Lebanon to new areas beyond the Litani River, while in northern Israel, temporary restrictions have been brought in for communities there as Hezbollah redoubles its cross-border rocket attacks.
The former First Minister of Scotland, Nicola Sturgeon, has told the BBC she feels she's serving a sentence for a crime she didn't commit. In her first media interview since her estranged husband, Peter Murrell, pleaded guilty to embezzling £400,000 from the SNP, the party she led for years, Ms. Sturgeon said Murrell's crimes had caused her to be publicly vilified. She told Laura Koonsberg she would not apologise for what happened.
For my own sake, but, you know, for the sake of people out there, a lot of women who end up finding themselves blamed for the actions of the men in their lives, I'm not going to contribute to that kind of sense that I am responsible for somebody else's crimes. I will take responsibility for the things I do, the decisions I make. I'm sitting here with you right now answering questions because I believe strongly in that accountability.
And you can hear more from that interview on Sunday with Laura Koonsberg on BBC One or the iPlayer from 9 o'clock this morning. The Metropolitan Police says 5 armed protection officers at Kensington Palace have been told to consider their actions after complaints about their conduct. The Sun newspaper says a female member of staff raised concerns about misogynistic behaviour, leading to the removal of the officers' passes. Scotland Yard said it had carried out an investigation and the officers' behaviour fell below the standards expected. A new species of fungus has been discovered that's been killing a moss in the UK that's aggressively invasive. The fungus is closely related to the one that causes ash dieback disease, which has killed up to 80 million British trees. But this species appears only to target the invasive heathstar moss. Dr. George Greif, a fungus specialist at Museum Wales in Cardiff, made the discovery.
I haven't heard of any other instances where that's happened, so it could genuinely be quite a rare phenomenon of kind of the British environment fighting back against this moss to try and restore balance. There's actually just one group of very closely related mosses that this fungus grows on, so it's not a threat to other trees and other wildlife as far as we know.
Dr. George Greif of Museum Wales, BBC News.
Charles Carroll, many thanks. This is BBC Radio 4. The concept of livability will be explained on Thinking Aloud. That's coming up in a moment. And then on this week's On Your Farm, we meet the new tenant farmers who are putting artificial intelligence at the heart of their farm business. That's in half an hour. And AI is also the focus here on Radio 4 on Wednesday afternoons.
The Artificial Human on Radio 4 returns for a new series to demystify the world of artificial intelligence.
I'm Alex Krotowski.
And I'm Kevin Fong. Join us as we look beyond the hype to answer the questions that AI can't.
With the World Cup this summer, should we replace football managers with AI?
Does anyone need to learn to program if AI can write all the software itself?
And if AI is transforming warfare, will humans still need to be on the front line?
The new series of The Artificial Human, Wednesday afternoons at 3:30 on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
Now on BBC Radio 4, here's Laurie Taylor with Thinking Aloud.
Hello, and a warm welcome to this new series of Thinking Aloud. Actually, today's topic rather forcefully reminds me of the Welcome to Sociology, which I typically extend to first-year students in my opening seminar at York University. Look, let's begin, I'd say, with a topic which, on the face of it, would seem like the very last one to have a sociological explanation, the highly individualistic topic of suicide. But that, I then point out, was exactly the phenomenon which exercised Emil Durkheim, one of the founding fathers of sociology, way back in 1897, over 100 years ago. I mean, he asked not about the psychology behind the individual act, but about why certain social or religious groups have higher incidences of suicide than others. And he concluded that the answer depended on their relatively high or low levels of social integration. Well, in today's programme, I'm going to be talking to two social researchers who, while they both thoroughly accept Durkheim's social interpretation of suicide, what they do, they're seeking to extend and refine his analysis. Those researchers are Alexander Oughton, who's senior lecturer in social and political science at the University of Lincoln, and Sarah Huck, who is senior research fellow in the School of Health in Social Science at the University of Edinburgh. They're co-investigators on a project entitled Discovering Livability, Co-Producing Alternatives to Suicide Prevention. Alex, before we hear a little about your own approach, can you just tell me a little bit more about how really the value of what Durkheim had to say?
Yes, absolutely. So Durkheim writes a book, Suicide, in 1897. So Durkheim looks at it, takes a statistical approach to trying to understand and explain suicide rates. So less interested in the individual, more interested in suicide rates at a population level. And essentially what Durkheim is saying is that suicide rates are proportional or linked to a group's social integration within society. Integration is the structural elements of social relationships, so shared beliefs and rituals in terms of people bonding together. And so Durkheim is really interested in understanding population-level suicide rates and explaining that using statistical, positivist statistical approach.
And this is really quite an outstanding thing to do, because on the face of it, why people commit suicide would seem to have only psychological explanations. But as you're pointing out, here is an intervention which establishes that the rates vary according to the degree with which individuals are socially integrated. How does the project that you and Sarah are both involved in, Discovering Livability, connect, if you like, to what Durkheim was talking about? And tell me a little bit more about this term. I mean, always welcome new sociological terms. This is a new one on me, livability.
Obviously, Durkheim was considering and had a belief in the social causes of suicide rather than the psychological approaches to understanding suicide located within the individual. Hence, he's using statistics. I think we also need to understand, in terms of what we do in our project as well, the context in which Durkheim was operating within. So essentially, when Durkheim was writing, new forms of government, new forms of governmentality were emerging. Governments are interested in effectively managing their populations, using statistics, using public health approaches. Durkheim isn't actually the first person to do this, but he's the person who gained the most traction. So livability is attempting to consider the social factors are relevant when we think about suicide. So trying to move away, so working within the tradition of Durkheim to a certain extent, trying to move away from seeing suicide as purely a problem of the individual, as individual pathology, and instead recognising that there are contexts and environments that can make people more vulnerable to suicide. And we are thinking about how we can create livable lives rather than simply working to try and prevent death. And so we think we're kind of trying to flip the question that's often happened within suicide prevention. So instead of thinking about why do people die by suicide, instead we're thinking about how can we create context and environments that makes people's lives more livable.
What we're talking about here is a more sensitive analysis of the social conditions surrounding suicide, something which hasn't really been so sensitively done in the past.
Yes, and because even within a lot of the sociological research, it tends to be that big number, quantitative data, missed, voices don't get heard. And I think when we think about preventing death, we know how we can prevent biological death. And that's what tends to come through in the suicide prevention policies. We just prevent somebody from dying at that moment. However, if we've saved somebody from taking their own life, but we've not addressed the causes that have got them to that point and created that vulnerability, then just preventing them at that time and then putting them back in the same social, economic context that has made them vulnerable, has made their life unlivable, then we're just going to continue going round and round. So livability makes us attuned to these broader contextual, structural, environmental facts that can have an impact on our fellow citizens' lives.
So, Sarah, what we're saying is that livability makes us look in more detail about the circumstances surrounding suicide and surrounding those people who are inclined to commit suicide.
Yes, livability is about all of the things that make life livable, but not from a we all have to be happy all the time kind of perspective. It's about the things that make you able to want to stay alive, to engage in your daily life. It's about thinking about suicide as a journey that is based in experience, embodiment, interaction with people, organizations, services, places, rather than thinking about it as the point of crisis. We prevent a suicide and we go back to the same circumstances.
And Alex?
I just think probably a pertinent example of that is the Royal College of Psychiatrists have released a media update saying that if you're a recent mother and you die by suicide, you're far more likely to live in a deprived area. And again, that is, what is that telling us? That is telling us that this is not just about pathology. It is about lives that, through the environments that we're creating as a society, are not livable, that those people struggle, that those people end up potentially taking their own lives. And I would argue that is why we are talking about livability rather than just preventing death. What can we do to make those new mothers' lives better?
Sarah, when I started looking at this, I thought inevitably suicide is a very difficult terrain, difficult area in which to go, emotionally, ethically, and I should imagine methodologically as well. Tell me about how you navigated these challenges.
Yes, so our project is very qualitative in nature. So the work that led into discovering livability involved long-term ethnographic work. It involved in-depth interviews with people who had experienced suicide, either been bereaved by suicide, had attempted suicide, or were professionals working in that space. And really, most of the people we spoke to fit into more than one of those broad categories. And we also conducted a modified sociological autopsy of suicide deaths in those areas, which entails looking at NHS or multi-agency reviews of deaths using a sociological lens to see what they say and don't say and what we can learn from them. So We were continuously navigating and adjusting how we went about the work for both the participants and our research team's well-being. I think a key point to this was the time scale of this. We had a lot of time. So the 1.5 to 2 years we spent doing the ethnographic work, that happened simultaneously and in the same areas as we were doing the other methods. So we were able to build trust gradually. We were able to have slow conversations and make sure people really understood what they were participating in.
You're bringing in people who've experienced suicide.
Yes.
And you're sitting them down. Whereabouts are you? Are you in the university or in a special meeting room or...?
No, so all over the place. So we, the three research fellows on that project, were embedded in the communities we worked in. So we lived and we worked there. And so our interviews happened wherever the person was most comfortable. So we did interviews in community centers, in people's homes.
Whereabouts were the community centers?
So these were in three broad areas of Scotland. Mm-hmm. So, you know, obviously for our ethical commitments, I can't tell you exactly where, but we had one research fellow in each area. And we worked with 11 community organizations in those areas. And I even did an interview in my car once because that's where the participant was comfortable.
And what would be a typical question you'd begin with? How would you get the discussion going?
We usually would ask people to just actually introduce themselves however they see fit. It's important to know that we never interviewed someone the first time we met them. So usually we had had 2, 3, 4 conversations with someone before we sat down to do a formal interview, which is, I think, the benefit of that embedded ethnographic approach. And then we would kind of go from there. So we had an interview guide, but it was very much led by people's stories.
So you're trying to find out, get an understanding of how suicide is embedded in the social lives of people. But the idea really that you want to do something to make their lives, if you like, more livable, so that in fact suicide, what is less likely to occur?
That's the aim of discovering livability, yes. And that comes out of this previous project where we were actually collecting experiences. And so in that project, we were looking at what does suicide look and feel like in a particular place at a particular time? How does this compare how we talk and how people experience it? And so we built this kind of really locally embedded knowledge base about how suicide was being experienced in these communities and the contributing factors to that. And that's led us into discovering livability.
It's an enormously important undertaking, this, isn't it? The idea of suddenly saying, I'm going to improve your livability, so therefore to make you less amenable to thoughts of suicide. Alex, how in concrete terms do you begin to intervene?
I think just to preface this with, we're not telling people what livability should look like to them. So we, as a project, are working with this concept of livability, but it is a very open concept because we don't want to tell people what their life would look like. But essentially, I guess we're doing this in three different ways. So we're using this concept of livability to work with policymakers and policy processes. So we're taking a critical approach to a lot of policies that already exist that are very much focused in terms of suicide prevention on this intervention at the point of crisis. And then we try and prevent somebody from dying, and then we just put them right back into the same context that maybe created those feelings of suicidality. So I think we can help intervene on that level. We're also changing how suicide research itself is being done. So we're centering the lived and living experience. Often that's been ignored. So people who have experience of suicidality in their own lives have often been marginalised within suicide research because either that research just looks at statistics at a population level, or it's because it comes from more psychological approaches where the person is seen as mentally ill and therefore they're marginalised and often their voices aren't heard. So working with people with lived and living experience, rather than just doing research on somebody, actually engaging them in the research process with us. And then thirdly, we're working with communities. So people who are out there working with people who are at risk of suicidality, we're doing work to try and help them to understand what good practice looks like.
Sarah, that prompts a question. I mean, this community dimension, I mean, tell me a little bit more about how the community fits in here.
That is something, again, that emerged from suicide cultures. It came through in a lot of ways, but I'll give you two key examples. So one of the key ways is that community groups of all shapes and sizes are filling a gap in services. They're doing suicide prevention, even if that's not in their remit. In some places, this looks like suicide-specific support groups, but also community centers, organizations supporting veterans, disability organizations, therapy gardens. Ah. These groups are recognizing that what they are doing is suicide prevention, and so do the people they support, but they're not often included in suicide prevention strategy or supported with enough funding to keep up that work, although Scotland's suicide prevention strategy in particular and their action plans are moving towards this. The other example is an element of kind of individuals within services going above and beyond that's involved in this type of work. And this comes through when we talk about especially the community of people who work in statutory services such as the NHS, inpatient settings, or the police service. And the actions of those individuals that felt to people experiencing suicidality as going above and beyond the norm of that service are the actions that make a huge difference in people's journeys. And I think this is because that personalized, often more caring, localized approach is no longer something people expect from statutory services, so they notice it when they experience it. And so both aspects of this kind of community-centered approach point to the importance of real connections, of local knowledge, and peer and lived experience-led approaches that actually meet people's needs where they are.
I must say this concept, as I've indicated already, livability was a new one on me. So to what extent, Alex, is this Discovering Livability project fit into some other established intellectual tradition, or is it something completely new?
I think what we're doing in terms of our specific actions on the project is new. However, we do also fit into an emerging trend of, I guess we call it, an approach to studying suicide, which is called critical suicide studies. So that's been going for since sort of the 2010s. And essentially, critical suicide studies, people within this approach come from a whole range of different disciplines, and they ask a range of different questions. So things like, who are the experts when it comes to suicide? Again, that feeds into our interest in lived and living experience. They're asking, where does power reside within suicide research? Whose voices are being heard, whose aren't? And who is suicide research for? Is it for the government to help effectively manage its populations, or is it to actually help individuals? And so critical suicide studies have attempted to address that and to challenge that. Critical suicide studies and our project don't see suicide and suicide prevention as a neutral act. Instead, it's wrapped up with other injustices such as race, gender, colonality. Where we're different is in the size of the project and the fact that we're using this concept of livability and thinking about alternatives to how suicide prevention works at the moment, very much in the sense of being there to prevent somebody from dying at that moment of crisis. I think where we're novel on the Discovering Livability project is we're coming at it from both a top-down and a bottom-up approach. So we're looking at how deliberate political decisions can make people more or less vulnerable to suicide. But then at the other side, we're also working with communities, working with people who've lived a living experience to centre those voices through a research agenda.
Let me move on to another aspect here, because this is an important one. It's the actual size of the issue, the scale. I mean, suicide, I should imagine for many people, it's still quite a secret, almost a hidden phenomenon. You know, the silence, taboos about it, we don't speak about it very much. I mean, what do we actually know about the numbers? Can I come to you on this, Sarah?
I will preface this by saying that suicide deaths are important to understand, but they are very rare, which makes using deaths as an outcome measure challenging, and that is really all our statistics at the moment capture. So in looking at the statistics, what they show depends on where you put your line. So since the 1980s, there was a general decrease in the suicide rate until 2008, when we start to see an increase again. But also, the standard of proof changed in 2017, so it can be hard to say. If we look at the most recent year-to-year statistics as reported by Samaritans, there was an increase in suicide deaths recorded in England, Wales, and Northern Ireland from 2023 to 2024. In England, that means the actual rate stayed the same, but in Northern Ireland, the suicide rate increased. In Scotland, over the same period, both suicide deaths and the suicide rate decreased. However, for example, we need to look at this with a more intersectional lens. So in that same sort of set of statistics in Scotland, the most deprived areas in Scotland were 2.5 times as high probable suicide mortality as in the least deprived areas in Scotland. So one of the things we really try hard to do is question the statistics and also what they obscure. So For example, we think about often a gender paradox in suicide, of women attempting suicide at a higher rate, but men dying more. And this is often attributed to the lethality of the means used. So this gender paradox often means women's distress isn't taken as seriously because their attempts are seen as, quote unquote, less lethal. But we can complicate that data in a number of ways. So if you add race to the mix, you can complicate that. We've only had statistics about race and suicide in England and Wales beginning in 2021, and we actually still don't have these numbers for Scotland. But work by a scholar called Dean Knipe has highlighted that mixed-race women had higher rates of suicide compared with the white British population. Additionally, the National Confidential Inquiry into Suicide and Self-Harm reported an increase in hanging deaths by women from an average of 39% of all female deaths in 2012 to 2015 to 46% in 2019 to 2022. So the idea that women use less lethal means, for example, as an explanation might be getting less relevant, but you kind of need to look beyond the overall rate. And we really would like to suggest that we need to move away from looking at suicide statistics, since probable deaths measure who dies, but not who attempts suicide or who experiences suicidal ideation or who self-harms. So we're moving from Durkheim looking at suicide as a social fact, which we can measure quantitatively, towards more recent sociological work that questions if quantitative data is factual or objective. And that data is really important and shows us potential trends and inequalities, but we need to be careful with it and avoid flattening and homogenizing everyone's experiences to the point where our efforts at prevention can't actually impact people's lives.
Let me continue on that sort of theme for a moment, Alex. I mean, talking about statistics on suicide, we just heard some concerns about the statistics that are available and what they might mean. But are you generally happy with such statistics, with the way they're assembled?
I think they have an important role to draw attention to issues. However, there's a politics to all of this. And again, this is where this idea of livability and focusing on political decisions is really important. So, for example, if, you know, the average general population suicide trend is about 11 per 100,000, the latest sort of Samaritan statistics, whereas in England and Wales, the number of people in prisons dying by suicide is 10.8 per 10,000. So the statistics are telling us something really important, such as the huge increase in deaths within prison compared to the general population. Nothing's been done about it.
And let's stay with this point about the way in which suicide is handled in different environments. I mean, Sarah, tell me about some of your findings on the way in which, for example, suicide is handled in prisons.
Yeah, so there is a lot of critical social science that's highlighted sort of the hierarchies of lives in Western countries, and folks who are imprisoned are often placed lower on that hierarchy because of their perceived badness. So we conducted a sociological autopsy of fatal accidents and sudden deaths inquiry reports on suicide deaths in prisons in Scotland. And we found that most of the time, these reports argue that there was no learning to be done by the system in relation to these deaths, because the deaths were either unforeseeable, as in there could have been no way to predict the death, or inevitable. This person was so mad or so pathologically suicidal that there was nothing that could have been done to prevent this death. And sometimes both, which is inherently contradictory. And you see, that is a very different message from the one that's used in suicide prevention campaigns in the general public. Those often take a zero suicide approach or an approach that says there is hope for everyone, all suicides are preventable.
It's interesting, isn't it, trying to have conversations about suicide? I mean, Alex, let me turn to you. I mean, you do encounter resistance when you start to talk about suicide to people, don't you?
On an individual level, people are often actually very happy to discuss. So when people ask me what I do, very rarely does that shut the conversation down. Very often they, even if they don't know somebody who's personally died by suicide, they've got an opinion. I think where it becomes problematic is at the political level, because the way that suicide is constructed and framed at the moment by government, essentially, that it is this pathological problem of the individual, that means that it's very hard for us to see where responsibility for these deaths lie. And so just to go back to the prison example, in policy and in practice, the prison is seen as a neutral environment. The reason that prison suicides are so high is because prisons are full of ill people or violent people. The prison regime is hidden in the shadows. I think politically, when you start talking about suicide, very often you come up against this approach, this discourse that says it's the individual. It's an ill individual, we need to help them. We don't need to think about the systems and what we're doing politically.
I want to stick with this question about people's readiness to talk about suicide, because in a way, people's readiness to talk about suicide is fundamentally important to your project. Am I wrong, Sarah, to say that people don't want to talk about suicide, or have you found ways to make them talk about suicide?
You know, it's interesting. I have rarely encountered resistance or reluctance on an interpersonal level. I once had someone say, no, I don't talk about suicide. And I accepted that and I didn't ask them about it again. I think because the methods that I use, I think, again, this is, goes to that. I spend deep time with people. And so I often get to build relationships that mean that if there is hesitation, it does eventually fall away. And I think more broadly in life, as Alex said, I also experienced that thing. As soon as someone finds out you're a suicide researcher, everyone has something to say about suicide. And I think that shows there's a real hunger to talk about this issue. But because it's taboo or fraught or seen as very distressing, people are reluctant to bring it up unless they feel like you're in a job or a role that means you can handle it. So I think we get a lot of conversation about suicide very easily from people because they feel like this is what we do for our job, so we can handle it. Whereas in their everyday lives, it's harder to have those conversations because you don't know what you're going to be then putting on someone else.
That sounds very positive. And Alex, are we seeing positive changes when we begin to talk about reducing the possibility of suicide, when we're talking about the way in which suicide is perceived?
I think there is more of a willingness and more awareness of the issue of suicide now. I mean, we see that in the setting up of men's sheds and, you know, these kind of groups who...
Men's sheds
are a movement, a group of different organisations who essentially bring men together to talk about general well-being and health and things like that. So there is this, I think, this shift in that it's okay for people to talk about suicide, but I think at the same time we focus very heavily on men's suicide and the suicide of a certain group of people, and that means that other groups are marginalised, other groups don't get that chance to discuss it. But in terms of my interest in politics and policy, I think we see a very different picture depending, obviously, suicide prevention is a devolved issue, so we've got all four nations of the United Kingdom. Some are doing better at trying to address suicide and suicidality. Others lag behind a bit. There's also a significant difference, I think, in terms of the local and national. So we have some local authorities that are fairly progressive in thinking about suicide and suicidality. There is some reason to be optimistic.
Yes, talking about progress and so on. I mean, Sarah, coming to you, I think it's true to say, isn't it, that this idea of livability, this concept we began today's discussion with, that's already being attended to by the Scottish Government.
Yes, so that has started to be incorporated in the Scottish Government's Suicide Prevention Action Plan related to the suicide prevention policy. And actually, just within the last few weeks, we had a really great workshop supported by our funder. And I think that's another important thing. So we're funded by Wellcome, and they fund a lot of really novel research that's pushing us, because they give us the ability to then engage with the folks working in the Scottish Government and the third sector on these suicide prevention action plans. So we don't want to enable governments to abdicate responsibility for that, but we do want to simultaneously figure out how we work within the constraints of our current politics. And increasingly, the role of communities, local approaches, and lived experience leadership is being recognized and embraced. And again, it's already being done. Regardless of support for it, communities are doing the work. And so we're hoping to be part of helping policymakers continue to recognize that resource before it burns out. And that passion and dedication there is the thing we return to when we find the hope that kind of helps us think about livability as opposed to all the despair.
Let me pick up on that positive note and thank you very much, Sarah Huck and Alex Oaten. Thank you both very, very much. And as usual, I'd enormously welcome any comments at all on this topic. You'll find me at thinkingaloud@bbc.co.uk. Let me conclude with one aspect of suicide that we've not considered. It's moral standing, the manner in which it's historically been condemned as wrong by mainly monotheistic religions. It was a condemnation which, I remember, it infuriated the atheist philosopher Schopenhauer. And I still remember the little phrase he used. Surely, he wrote, there's nothing in the world a man has more incontestable right to than his own life and person.
Thinking Aloud is presented by Laurie Taylor. It's produced by Natalia Fernandez. And if you're suffering distress or despair and need support, including urgent support, a list of organisations that can help is available at bbc.co.uk/actionline.
Things just swirling around my head. Am I really the product of this?
Astonishing secrets uncovered by at-home DNA tests.
Little did I know what more was to come.
I'm Jenny Kleeman, and in the new series of The Gift, we'll hear more stories emerging out of the ever-expanding global DNA database.
I did know that I was different.
You had kids together.
Yeah.
Then we met.
Then we met.
The Gift. Listen on BBC Sounds.
In half an hour after the news here on BBC Radio 4, our programme Sunday reflects on Pope Leo's first encyclical, which addressed, among others, how humanity should respond to the AI revolution and the Church's historic complicity in slavery. Sunday is at 7:10. Now, on your farm with Rebecca Rooney in Lancashire.
The calf shed is full of these beautiful calves, all looking at us, all having a nose, and there's a mixture of colours, some black, a couple of russet ones, some white. They're very nosy. They're chewing the cud, so I guess, are they weaned then, Hannah, these?
Yeah, so once they get to this stage, they're a weaned calf. They come in at 2 weeks old on average.
We're in the calf shed at Cinderhill Farm near Lancaster, and this is a Duchy of Lancaster farm. It's recently been taken over by a young couple, Joe Towers and Hannah Kent, who've not long taken on the farm, but are managing it in a really cutting-edge way.
We've got the 285 acres of grassland where we've got beef and sheep, and then we've got this calf enterprise, where the calves typically arrive here from dairy herds, beef, dairy crosses.
And what kind of calves are they?
We've got Angus in here, blues, Simmentals, and we've also got some Limousins over there. We tend to keep the native calves with us to graze afterwards, so they're the Herefords and the Angus heifers in case we want to use them as part of our breeding herd later.
And this part of Cinderhill Farm would be very familiar to any farmer who's got beef, but you do manage them in a very high-tech way, don't you, Joe? I mean, you have brought your laptop to the barn because you want to just explain to me how your whole farm business is informed and shaped by using AI.
Yeah, I've very much been a enthusiastic early adopter of artificial intelligence. It has also been part of my job prior to this farming tenancy, as well as some consulting. I do use it quite enthusiastically in regards to the operational side of the farm. It helps us think through the plan for the farm. In terms of the calf enterprise here, as you say, I've got my laptop and there's a calf dashboard on there.
You've got the number of animals on the farm, you've got your like an annual progress so far. And how would you use this data? What would you do?
So most people are familiar with using AI. They use it just through the kind of web browser, the chatbot, and sometimes they're in a little bit of a vacuum and they don't necessarily have what we call a kind of persistent record of information.
So that's just like a running record, you'd keep it updated on a very regular basis?
Yeah, so about 12 months ago, a company popularised a technique where you access that artificial intelligence in a part of your computer called the terminal, where it's able to write files, create installations, integrate with lots of other apps and so forth. And that means that every time I go and have one of those conversations, a folder on the laptop is being updated.
So you mean a conversation with the computer?
Correct. Yeah, I do. I do. And typically, every time I would then open a new chat, I would provide the file path to that folder, and the AI would scan all of that information, and then I'm effectively having a conversation at that point with an AI which has a vast amount of specific contextual data about this business.
And Hannah, in terms of using all this data and this AI kind of analysis, what concrete difference does it make, or what changes have you made in the way you manage the calves?
Yeah, so it's helped us massively of knowing exactly where we are financially and at what stages of growth, how much money we've got in them calves at those different stages of growth. Joe's got data from the moment these calves arrive on farm to the moment they leave, and a cost base of what inputs we've put into those calves on a day-by-day basis. When the calves get to 3 months old and I'm ready to take them to the auction to sell at market, I know exactly how much money that calf needs to make in order to be able to be profitable.
This is very much real-time information that informs everything you do.
Yeah, absolutely, and which, you know, has been a massive benefit to us, obviously, being new tenants. Every penny matters at this stage.
And are there very practical changes you've made because of this?
We've changed the age that we're selling the calves. The AI system has up-to-date information about the cost of the animals and the rearing cost per day through the different phases of their life. And it also has all of the receipts from the auction. It's able to identify the correct sweet spot to sell the animals to maximise that return. And we have made adjustments on the basis of that information.
Do you think that what you're doing is a kind of realistic model for other farms?
Yeah, I do. It's actually quite easy to do. Well, it's like anything, it's easy if you know how, but I think it's not the difficulty that stops people, it's the perception of difficulty. I think there's actually a massive gap now between AI capability and levels of adoption. It's not that much that you need to know to actually get going, and I think people would be a little bit surprised how little the knowledge is to actually get going. The key part of it is that the context in that folder needs to be regularly refreshed and updated, otherwise you get what's known in the AI industry as context rot or stale context. I get a real kick out of keeping it up to date, and it's not hard. You know, I can just be sat with the laptop on my knee in front of the television with my family and say, okay, these calves arrived today or whatever. But if you don't maintain, and it would become less useful and you'd stop using it probably. So I see large language models, I consider it a very bottom-up technology. If a farmer is motivated to do it and can see the potential for the rewards, and it has to be them that maintains it. It can't be a consultant like me, for example, because it really needs to be the person who knows the business intimately, working in the business each day, that just remembers once a day or twice a day. And you can do it from your phone. You can link these.
So you can just speak it. You can just speak into your phone. It's not like you have to log in and upload a whole spreadsheet or anything. You can just say, "I have spent X amount today on this."
Yeah, you can just photograph it, put it into your phone. You can update, you can say, I just use this medicine, put it into your phone. And I think farmers will access these sorts of tools from the phone, and hopefully in that regard it could be quite habitual.
And Hannah, have you got into these habits? Are you good at giving the AI fresh information so it keeps learning and keeps giving you better advice?
I think I'm a little bit spoilt, really, because I've got Joe as my right-hand man, so I end up giving it to Joe, who then puts it into the AI. But there's no reason I couldn't do it. There's absolutely no reason. I have got it set up on my phone, but yeah, just for my own, it's just, I just tell Joe and Joe tells the AI.
Oh, you can smell they've been doing a bit of muck spreading.
That's right, yeah, we have just spread a bit untimely, wasn't it, really? But it's very thin layer, so it's not smothered any of the grass.
And we're in another of your fields. Can see a lake over in the distance. And this is a big field. And what are we looking for in here, Joe?
We're looking for 5 1-year-old Angus cross heifers which started life in the Calf Enterprise, and we liked them, and we've had them outwintered. They thrived being outside through the winter. Angus is obviously quite a hardy native breed. They're very, very docile, good temperament, because they were had the first part of their life in the Calf Enterprise, being mollycoddled by Hannah. We'll just have to see how many we dare try to outwinter this coming winter, because I think one of the reasons it's been a success is because it's obviously is quite a low number on a large amount of land.
Oh, and we found them round the corner through the hedge, and here they are, five black Anguses looking very hard at us. Oh, a hare, yeah. A giant hare just ran right in front of us. And off he goes. Gosh, that made me jump.
I did it.
They're just coming up to say hello and having a bit of a lick. I mean, you two haven't been here very long, but you've got such vision. You seem so at home here. What was it like going through that whole process to apply for a tenancy?
I mean, we've been remarkably lucky, because at the time that this tenancy opportunity came available, Hannah and I were actually, we were kind of needing to move. Even though we weren't farming on a large scale before, we were living in a beautiful farmhouse, and the lady that had asked us to actually look after the farmhouse had sadly passed away, and that was being sold, and it was above our budget. So we were incredibly fortunate that this opportunity became available. Lots of people, young people looking for a tenancy, move right across to the other side of the country. Our son hasn't even had to change his primary school. And our values and the things that we want to do and the vision, as you say, aligns with the landlords.
Because there's another hare over there. Gosh, your fields are full of them. So the duchy was after tenants who would farm in a greener way.
Yeah, a gentle approach to farming. So we actually had a big stroke of fortune that ahead of our interview in Lancaster Castle, we bumped into a friend, and he made some suggestions of research we could do ahead of the interview. So it turned out that by the time of the interview, we were kind of already in complete alignment, really, with what the duchy were hoping they'd be able to do with tenants farming the land. So, yeah, it's been great. We've had a lot of support and enjoyed it a lot.
What was that interview at Lancaster Castle like? That must have been nerve-wracking.
Extremely nerve-wracking, yeah, as you can well imagine. I'm not sure I ever relaxed into it. At one point, they did sort of say, like, Hannah, you know, you can relax. Like, you don't need to be so nervous. But obviously, it's in a very emotional subject, isn't it? You know, it's a passion that me and Joe have had for a long time, and it's there within grasp, but you've not quite grasped it yet. So it is a very emotional journey. But we did manage to come out the other side of it. So we're extremely, extremely grateful and extremely happy.
And extremely proud. I mean, you've done brilliantly, haven't you? And you're kind of obviously kindred spirits. You met while you were students at Harper Adams. What kind of drives you, do you think?
We've both grown up on family farms. I grew up on a pig farm, probably my passion for pigs. And Joe grew up on a dairy farm. I've always wanted to be a farmer. I've always wanted to be hands-on and in that environment and work with the animals. Big passion for livestock, and especially very, very proud of my calves. You know, we all have our areas of expertise as such. So I like to deal with the livestock and my calves, and Joe's very much at home in the business side of it, and obviously with his AI and things and pushing that side of it to be much more fine-tuned.
And you've always been a bit of an innovator, Joe, haven't you? Because didn't you develop this special barista milk for your family dairy business?
Yes, I think I am by nature. Some people by nature do like to try out a lot of ideas and try and think, you know, what does the future look like? What's coming down to the track? What can we do differently? And yeah, I think farming does need to be a healthy industry. It does need people trying new ideas. To have a farm here with Hannah and that balance of skills that we've got execute those and be aligned on what we want to do, and similarly with the Duchy of Lancaster. Fantastic.
Ooh, got a bit of silage upon... Oh, yes, yeah. I'd love to look at the pigs, Hannah.
So these are my large black cross with saddleback pigs. We've got a large black boar just in the end over here. And basically the long-term plan with these is to get them out into the woodland to behave really naturally and obviously then to sell the meat.
It's quite a big old shed with whitewashed walls and big old rafters, and at one end of the shed we can see a line of...
2,000 a boar.
And so those are the old ones at the end of the shed.
And the boar, and then we've got the progeny down here, but these are not a million miles off getting ready to go.
And have you got a local abattoir that can process them for you?
Yeah, we do. He's just the other side of Preston. From him, they go to a butcher who's actually another tenant on the Duchy estate.
And so here, these look like the teenage pigs. That's so you've got one, two, three, four, five... lovely black and white ones. It's just having a good scratch there.
Absolutely.
On the step.
Yeah, they've got all their brushes and obviously straw bedding at the back.
How many pigs do you anticipate having? How big will this section of the farm business be?
The pigs are one of Hannah's very many passions when it comes to animals. What we'd like to do long term is have them in the woodland so that we can add value to the pigs in terms of the marketing side and generate an income. They just need to pay their way, really, don't they, Hannah?
what a great woodland management tool.
Absolutely, yeah, definitely. They have a place on the farm, I would say. But yeah, they are one of my favourite animals.
We've left the farmyard and come into a field which is a really beautiful sight. There's a flock of sheep with their lambs, white and a couple of black ones, grazing in the sunshine. There's a river flowing down the valley and the sunlight's catching it. Bridge going over the river and hills away into the distance.
You're looking at the Forest of Bowland, one of the ancient hunting forests, I think.
So how many sheep have you got and how do they fit in with your vision for running the farm?
This is a fantastic part of the world for growing grass. As you can see, there's a lovely pasture here. Our core business strategy is to maximise the utilisation of that grass, which is harvesting energy from the sunlight and avoiding purchasing additional inputs such as compounded feed and even fertiliser. So I guess the missing part of that puzzle is grazing animals, and animals that can also be accommodated in the winter outside. So sheep are a fantastic fit because, of course, they're brilliant grazers, but on fairly heavy clay in Lancashire, we can very confidently have them out in the winter eating grass as well.
And outdoor lambing, don't have to bring them indoors for that?
Going forward, we definitely want to be lambing outside. We won't be lambing inside if we can help it.
So that, again, is part of this extensive management of quite a mixture of businesses. So you've got your calves, you've got your sheep, you've got your handful of pigs to manage forests, but how will you make money off this?
One of our biggest strengths is flexibility. So to some extent, this farm was a blank canvas for us. It was really so exciting because it was a blank canvas where we could mould our farming strategy to the farm and the land and the infrastructure and the different constraints and opportunities, but also our own preferences and what we think will work for us. And also developing the farm, the asset base in terms of the stock, from more or less a standing start. So the priority is maximising the use of the grass and the flexibility around being able to buy and sell livestock avoids us having to carry the same numbers through the summer and the winter, because that would obviously undermine the strategy a little bit by having to have a lot of housing and a lot of inputs.
And farming extensively, does that mean you can also tie in with any of the government's agri-environment schemes?
Yes. Many of the farming practices that we are interested in adopting anyway attract an income from those schemes. So for one example would be low nutrient grassland, which is a payment in the sustainable farming incentive. Similarly, you can attract payments for such as herbal lays, which is a diverse sward, which is what we want as well for resilience and having a long grazing season and mitigating supplementary feed. And then even more bold, perhaps, is the countryside stewardship higher tier agroforestry option, which is available at the moment, where we have a draft for a silvo pasture on the farm, which is essentially rows of trees with alleys between them, 18 metres apart, where the livestock will graze between the alleys. So if we get a fair wind, that could give us quite a bit of financial security in terms of the public money contribution to the farm going forwards.
We're just walking through the yard and the builders are in. They're working on the farmhouse because at the moment it's such early days in the tenancy that the farmhouse is being updated and you're not in yet.
Not yet, imminently. We will be in very soon, thank goodness. But no, it's been nice because we've been part of the renovation process.
You've got a very fine red rooster sitting on the fence post over there. And your son, he's 8, he's at school today.
Right, yeah.
But he'd quite like to have a little chicken enterprise, would he, or George?
Yes, that's right. I think he saw a gap in the market that there wasn't very many egg sales at the end of drives in Dolphin Home, so decided for his birthday he'd quite like some of his own chickens, and decided actually that he wants lots of different coloured eggs to be a bit more niche, I suppose. So we eventually, when we get moved into the farmhouse, we are going to set him up with that. He's got his money ready to go and buy some chickens.
For posh eggs?
Yeah, very posh eggs.
I mean, it has been quite interesting actually, because George just turned 8, so around 12 months ago we were applying for the tenancy, and we were doing the business plan, and there was lots of talk about business plans, and then George started talking quite a lot about his own business plan, and then as tenants of the Duchy of Lancaster we were extremely privileged that His Majesty the King came to visit us earlier this year. George got his business plan out of his pocket and showed it to His Majesty the King, which is a wonderful memory that we're going to absolutely cherish forever.
And so the King read it. And did it get the Royal Seal of Approval, the business plan?
Absolutely.
On Your Farm from Lancashire was produced and presented by Rebecca Rooney, and it's a BBC Audio Bristol production for BBC Radio 4. Coming up on Sunday, we hear about a diet inspired by the Bible that has found new audiences online in America. That's in 10 minutes after the news and a paper review. Later, today's Sunday worship is a celebration of the Saddleworth Wit Walks and Brass Band Contest. Sunday worship is at 10 past 8. Time now for a weather update. Let's say good morning to Elizabeth Rizzini.
Good morning back, Neil. Well, yesterday, a few stations in London reached 30 degrees Celsius. Today, though, it's a lot cooler here and elsewhere by a good few degrees or so. Temperatures still slightly above the seasonal average for many, but they will be dropping back to average as we head through next week, which is also looking rather unsettled as well. It's the first day of the meteorological summer, ironically, tomorrow. Anyway, today it's a day of sunny spells and some scattered showers. A slightly fresher feel to things this morning, most of our temperatures having dropped back to the low to the mid-teens in Celsius. For the Northern Isles today, there's some frontal rain. That's with us through this morning, eventually clearing into the afternoon. For the rest of Scotland, sunny spells and some showers. Some of those showers will be fairly frequent. They could be heavy and possibly thundery through the afternoon across northern Scotland in particular. Further south across England, Wales and Northern Ireland, then there's some areas of cloud, especially this morning towards southern counties, but also some bright and some sunny spells emerging for many. For the high ground and coast towards the west, there will be thicker cloud, perhaps a few spots of drizzle at times, and a good few showers towards western areas as well. They'll be fairly well scattered. The showers tending to fade away through the afternoon, and some of us across East Anglia and southeast England in particular could stay mostly dry throughout the day. Gentle southwesterly winds, and it's cooler than it was on Saturday. Top temperatures in Scotland and Northern Ireland, mid to high teens in Celsius. England and Wales, high teens to low 20s, but we could still get to 23 or 24 degrees Celsius in southeast England and East Anglia. Overnight tonight, it's a fairly quiet night. Northern Scotland and Northern Ireland seeing some more showers. Elsewhere, it's dry with clear skies. For central and eastern areas, staying rather cloudy towards the west. With an approaching weather front, there'll be outbreaks of rain into western Scotland, northwestern and southwestern England, western Wales by the time we get to dawn. Temperatures dipping back to around about where they are at the moment. Tomorrow, there'll be some heavy rain at times.
Right, many thanks, Elizabeth Rizzini. Later today, a new quizzing season starts on Radio 4.
Every Sunday afternoon, test yourself with a new collection of quizzes across a wide range of subjects.
Right, let's test you then.
Starting with books.
Hello, I'm Claire Balding and welcome to Bookmarks, the brand new quiz for Britain's most passionate book lovers.
Life is too short to finish a rubbish book.
Then numbers. Join me, Max Fosh, for your Numbers Up, a brand new quiz show in which you're solving for X and constantly asking why. Plus travel, as Simon Reeve hosts the globe-trotting quiz around the world in 80 ways.
Oh,
test yourself with a new summer of quizzing this afternoon at 4:30. To listen on your smart speaker, just say Play Radio 4.
BBC News at 7 o'clock on Sunday the 31st of May. This is Charles Carroll. The headlines this morning: several hundred people are arrested across France as supporters of Paris Saint-Germain clash with police after the club's Champions League victory. Israel says it's expanding its military offensive in southern Lebanon, and scientists in Cardiff discover a new fungus that could fend off an invasive moss. French police have arrested more than 400 people across the country after violence broke out during Paris Saint-Germain's Champions League final win against Arsenal. The majority of the arrests were in Paris. The French Interior Minister, Laurent Nunez, has called the unrest unacceptable after seven police officers were injured. Our Paris correspondent, James Waterhouse, has just sent this report.
From the moment Arsenal missed the penalty to hand PSG the Champions League trophy, fireworks started exploding throughout central Paris. However, after accusations of being caught off guard last year, when two people died after the team also won, the police presence this time was muscular. 22,000 officers were deployed across France, with 8,000 in Paris. Several businesses were damaged, say police. We saw one shop being looted as fans, mostly teenagers, poured into the capital streets. Tear gas was occasionally deployed, but the scenes were mostly of genuine celebration. A parade involving the players will take place later this afternoon at the Champ de Mars in front of the Eiffel Tower.
Israel's military says that it's expanding its ground campaign against Hezbollah into more parts of southern Lebanon. Airstrikes have been carried out north of the Litani River, which was previously the northern boundary of Israel's offensive. The IDF said that one soldier had been killed in a drone attack by Hezbollah. As the war in Lebanon intensifies, US media is reporting that President Trump has made amendments to the latest draft of a possible preliminary deal with Iran. From Jerusalem, here's our correspondent Sebastian Usher.
After anticipation once again rose in the past couple of days that a deal between the US and Iran was about to be closed, the latest reports in the US media suggest that momentum has once again ebbed. Official sources have told reporters that President Trump has hardened the terms of the agreement from the US side, and a new framework has now been sent back to Iran. That suggests there could be days or even weeks of more negotiations before a final decision is made by either side to sign up to any deal. In the vacuum, Israel and Hezbollah have continued to descend into deeper conflict. The Israeli military has just said that it's expanding its ground operations in South Lebanon to new areas beyond the Litani River, while in northern Israel, temporary restrictions have been brought in for communities there as Hezbollah redoubles its cross-border rocket attacks.
Health officials in Brazil say they've identified a suspected case of Ebola. If confirmed, it would be the first infection outside Africa since the current outbreak began in the Democratic Republic of Congo. The man, who's in his 30s, had recently returned from a trip to the DRC. He's being kept in isolation. The BBC's Marina Rossi sent this report from Sao Paulo.
The patient is a 37-year-old man from the DRC who had recently returned to Brazil. Health authorities say he developed symptoms including fever, meeting the criteria for a suspect case of Ebola. He is currently in isolation at a state institute for infectious disease, following strict biosafety protocols. An initial test indicates meningitis, but it doesn't rule out Ebola, and investigations are ongoing. Officials say the risk of Ebola reaching Brazil remains very low, noting no record cases in the country to date.
The former health secretary, Wes Streeting, has suggested cutting employers' national insurance to encourage businesses to hire more young people. Speaking to the Sunday Times, Mr. Streeting, who has said that he will stand in a possible Labour leadership contest, also backs the issuing of new licences for drilling in the North Sea. Here's our political correspondent, Damian Grammaticus.
This is yet another intervention from Wes Streeting, setting out how he'd seek to do things differently were he to become Prime Minister. He told the Sunday Times ways had to be found to make it easier for business to employ young people, and floated the idea of a targeted reduction in employers' national insurance. Labour's 2024 budget increased the rate paid by employers and lowered the starting threshold. Billions raised have been invested in the NHS, which Mr. Streeting oversaw as Health Secretary until a fortnight ago, but he has not suggested any cuts to the NHS budget. He also told the newspaper that allowing new drilling in the North Sea would bring higher tax receipts, even if it did not bring down energy bills, and said while climate change had to be tackled, the government should listen to the unions, the oil and gas workforce, and the public.
The Metropolitan Police says that a group of armed protection officers at Kensington Palace have been told to consider their actions after complaints about their conduct. The Sun newspaper says that a female member of staff raised concerns about misogynistic behaviour, leading to the removal of the officers' passes. Barry Caffery reports.
The five royalty and specialist protection officers are alleged to have behaved inappropriately on several occasions between August 2023 and September 2024. A spokesperson for the Metropolitan Police said the reported behaviour fell below the high standards expected, particularly for officers in frontline protective roles. The Met said that after an internal investigation, the officers received what it called reflective practice to consider their actions and identify learning for the future. The allegations were not found to meet the threshold for misconduct. The Sun says senior royal household staff took the decision to stop the officers from working at any palaces in the future by removing their passes. Scotland Yard says it remains a priority that all officers and staff uphold the highest standards of professionalism.
A new species of fungus has been discovered that's been killing a moss in the UK, which is aggressively invasive. Scientists from Museum Wales say it's a rare fight back, raising hopes that some habitats damaged by the moss can be restored. Our climate and science correspondent Georgina Rannard reports.
About 2,000 non-native plants and animals have been brought to Britain from other countries, among them the heathstar moss, which has been taking over native mosses. But a scientist from Amgueddfa Cymru Museum in Cardiff noticed that the foreign invader was dying in some areas, killed off by a fungus. He found that it was a close relative of the ash dieback fungus that's killed up to 80 million ash trees in Britain. However, he believes this fungus destroys only the invasive heathstar moss and could be a rare example of the British environment fighting back, helping save native species.
Returning now to last night's football, Paris Saint-Germain's win in Budapest saw them become only the second team in history to retain the Champions League and deny Arsenal a first European title in the club's 140-year history. Our sports correspondent Andy Swiss reports from Budapest.
It is very tough to accept, said Arsenal manager Mikel Arteta after his team's penalty shootout heartbreak, but added that he was proud of what his players had achieved. Despite their defeat, Arsenal still have plenty to cheer. This afternoon, they'll have an open-top bus parade in North London to celebrate their first Premier League title in 22 years. They might have hoped to show off the Champions League trophy too, but for Arsenal fans, it's still been a season to savour.
Andy Swiss. We'll now look at some of the Sunday papers. The Sunday Times this morning says US court documents show a man suspected of planning attacks against the Jewish community in London met Iran's supreme leader 3 days before the Ayatollah was killed. Mohammad Bakr Saad Daoud al-Sadi is alleged to have directed attacks in real time through a smartphone app from a bunker in Iraq, according to the paper. It says that the documents describe al-Sadi and Ali Khamenei's relationship as close. Sir Keir Starmer has been accused of going easy on benefit fraud to prevent the system from collapsing, according to the Sunday Telegraph. The paper says the number of personal independence claimants has risen to record levels, and new rules will soon allow people over 25 to receive support for 4 years after an initial assessment. The Telegraph has seen minutes from a government meeting in which officials warn that the system will fall over if capacity pressures are not addressed. The government spokesperson tells the paper that the changes are helping health professionals spend more of their time where it's needed. And a report in the Mail on Sunday says an upcoming biography of the Reform UK leader Nigel Farage claims he was banned from appearing on Radio 4's Desert Island Discs. The book, by the Conservative peer Lord Ashcroft, quotes an unnamed BBC source as saying Mr Farage has effectively been blacklisted and is instinctively regarded as unacceptable by many staff. The Reform leader tells the Mail he expects nothing less. The BBC says that it does not ban any individuals from the programme. A look at some of Sunday's papers.
Many thanks, Charles Carroll. Now on BBC Radio 4, time for Sunday with William Crawley.
Thanks very much. Good morning. A few weeks on from Tommy Robinson's Unite the Kingdom rally, we'll hear from Christians who were there for very different reasons.
I do believe that it's a God of love, but he's also come to bring a sword, not literally, but he does bring division by his words.
The use of Christian symbols doesn't necessarily mean that something aligns with who Jesus is, and we're told by Jesus himself that we will know a tree by its fruit.
Also this morning, so-called biblical diets have become a thing in America. But is eating like an ancient Near Eastern prophet actually good for your health? And we hear the case for returning to the earth a little differently, the campaign to make human composting a legal alternative to burial and cremation.
This concept is the best we can do to be together again, that the DNA is mixing and whatever else, it's in God's hands.
Your emails to sunday@bbc.co.uk, and while you're at it, you can tell us which food you are hoping makes the biblical diet list and which you are praying doesn't. We're on social media at BBCR4Sunday. Artificial intelligence needs to be disarmed. The words of Pope Leo as he spoke last Monday, launching the first major teaching document of his pontificate, an encyclical titled Magnifica Humanitas, which translates as Magnificent Humanity. Unusually, the Pope presented the new encyclical himself, a measure of the significance he attaches to the challenges he's addressing here, how humanity should respond to the AI revolution, the Church's historic complicity in slavery, and whether Catholic teaching on just war theory is still fit for purpose in an age of drone strikes and AI targeting. Anna Rowlands, Professor of Catholic Social Thought and Practice at Durham University, was on the panel at the launch event in Rome.
The key messages that he wanted people to hear, that he wants AI to be disarmed in this very striking phrase. I think he wanted to convey that very, very personally to the room. And I think that landed very hard with people. I think that he wanted to be in engagement and dialogue, not only with the tech sector, and there's been a lot of coverage, obviously, of the presence of Anthropic on the panel, but with those who were most affected and impacted by AI changes. Workers, families, those who themselves are being drawn into spending a lot of time on AI. So he wanted to signal that I'm listening, I want a dialogue, and we want this shared space, not these private spaces, which are dominated by boardroom profit motives. But we need these shared spaces in which people can talk about the common good ends of AI.
What the Pope here says about just war theory should make many headlines all by itself. That theory meaning that armed conflict can only be morally permissible if it meets certain strict criteria, including just cause, legitimate authority, proportionality, the protection of civilians and the like. But the Pope here says it's outdated. And I wonder if what we're seeing in this encyclical is Pope Leo dispatching this long ethical tradition within Catholicism?
Yes and no. I think that it's a very strong statement, as you say. He does say it's outdated. But in fact, if you look at the footnote to the document, which most people won't, it references Fratelli Tutti, Pope Francis's encyclical, in which he made a very similar point. And the point is this: the danger is, to quote Cardinal Cupich, that just war theory is seen as a permission slip, that it's seen as a way of legitimating. If you think you can tick the boxes, then you can justify your conflict. And that was never really how just war theory was meant to function. So Pope Francis before him and now Pope Leo have both been saying we need to subject just war theory to some moral performance review. And this document finds it wanting. It says we need a wider framework. And just war theory has always been situated in the Catholic tradition within a wider framework of seeking peace. And we need in this moment to not over rely on just war theory as if that alone is sufficient to ensure that criteria of a just peace is pursued.
Let me take you to a third topic, Anna. In addition to AI more generally and just war theory, the history of slavery and the Church's, Christianity's historic complicity in that awful, dark chapter in human history. We hear things from this Pope we haven't heard before.
Yes, that's true. And it's long overdue, many would say, including myself. So this text makes very clear that there is an institutional dimension to that responsibility for the history of slavery. In the past, previous popes have apologised for the role of individual Christians, as it were, in justifying slavery and trading in human persons, which can never be an acceptable thing. This text says that Pope Leo's predecessors and the Church institutional must now seek pardon for their own complicity in those acts. Now, crucially, this isn't just a historical apology, it is that, but also it's set within the context of saying, and this is a really emotional cry that the Pope makes in this text, he doesn't want his own successors in 100 or 200 years' time to be looking back on our era right now and saying that we did not act on the new forms of slavery, modern slavery and human trafficking that mar our world now. And there's every reason to think that contemporary technologies, including AI, rely on forms of slavery and also are active in the trafficking that they're used for the trafficking of human people. So he wants to say historical apology and pay attention right now. This isn't just about the past. This is about the contemporary reality of what is just underneath the surface of these technologies.
I don't know about you, Anna, but this feels like more than one encyclical to me. There's so much rich and provocative material in this document. How do you think, on the whole, this is likely to shape or reshape the future direction of the Catholic Church?
If Pope Francis was very well known for saying in Laudato Si that there was a real urgency to the climate crisis and to the environmental challenge that we face, this document says if we're going to face that challenge, we now need to see that we have to safeguard the human being at the heart of our social system in order to deal with these interconnected crises that we now face or challenges. That includes the climate crisis. It includes a kind of crisis of political life, and it includes a set of questions that arise with immense urgency around contemporary technologies. So it's an attempt to resituate the human, the value of the human being, and also the beauty of being human, that it's not something to be despised, it's not something to be overcome. We're not better if we're more machine than person. And he wants basically to call us back urgently to the interconnectedness of these crises that want to dehumanize humanize us and to call us to really think about the way in which we're using our power. And there's a wonderful line in the text, written 100 years ago, in fact, that basically says one of the problems we have in the modern era is we are not well trained in how to use power well. And for me, that's a connecting thread that runs through the whole text.
Professor Anna Rowlands. Tomorrow is Dorset Day, a date chosen because it's the feast day of the patron saint of that south coast county, Saint Wita. And remarkably, the remains of that Saxon holy woman have lain undisturbed in a church which has been a site of pilgrimage for Christians for more than 1,000 years, perhaps uniquely amongst English churches. Steve Harris has the story.
So the idea is you kneel and pray and put your head in the holes?
Put your head, put anything else that is hurting in the holes.
Right.
So it's for physical bodily contact with the saint.
Reverend Virginia Luckett is the vicar in the Golden Cap Benefice here on the Dorset coast. The Church of St Candida and the Holy Cross is just one of her 12 churches, but surely her most remarkable.
Yeah, I mean, I would say in terms of rural churches, this isn't on the modest scale. And in fact, you know, colloquially around here, people call it the Cathedral of the Vale.
You must explain to me, St Wita and St Candida, they are the same person?
They absolutely are. So the church was built around her. She was a Saxon saint, so she's early medieval. And so because her name is Wita, and it looks like white, they named it Candida, which is Latin for white.
So here are the remains of St. Wita, enclosed in a leaden casket, surrounded by marble. And underneath, there are these three oval holes. And inside, dozens and dozens of pink, yellow and green and white prayer cards.
This is a prayer from a child who is praying for their grandma. Because we have so many people visiting, we've taken to printing a batch of different coloured cards so that we know how old the cards are in the shrine.
The fact that the remains of St Wita survived the Reformation of Henry VIII and Thomas Cromwell is what makes this place unusual in terms of C of E churches.
How on earth they were not destroyed is inexplicable. It's very, very, very unusual.
This is Dr. Jan Graffius, the curator of historic collections at Stonyhurst College, a school near Clitheroe. She's an expert in relics because her Jesuit college, founded in the late 16th century, has its fair share of them.
We probably got, 500 from across the UK, but also the relics that we have go back to the early days of the church. So we've got a piece of the True Cross. And we have 21 former pupils and teachers of our school who were executed for their faith, three of whom are now saints, and 10 of whom have been beatified. So you had effectively 1,700 years of Catholic relics in the chapel in the school.
And what about the bones of St Wita, which have survived undisturbed for over 1,000 years? Is there anything like them?
There are places such as St Winifred's Well in North Wales. Now, that's not where relics were. That was a holy well. And that continued as a scene of pilgrimage all the way through the Reformation. But there were no relics there. It was just simply this miraculous well. That's the only other comparable example I can think of. But as far as St Wita is concerned, I don't know of another example. It's highly unusual.
I moved here because I wanted to move out of London.
St Wita was recognised as a saint by King Alfred the Great in the 9th century. She's said to have lit a fire on the top of nearby Golden Cap Hill to warn locals about an imminent Viking invasion. And when she died in the subsequent battle, this church was built to house her remains. And it's still a site of pilgrimage today.
The other day I did a service with probably about 6 or 7 people, and we could hear some chattering going on outside, and there was then a man came in, and he said, "Can we come and have a look at the church?" And then he brought in 50 people.
The Reverend Virginia Luckett there, ending that report from Steve Harris. What would Jesus eat? It's a question inspiring a growing number of Americans to rebuild their diets around foods mentioned in the Bible. The trend has found a new audience online, with influencers promoting everything from the Daniel fast to ancient grain bowls. Abby Stasier is a case in point. She's a qualified dietitian and founder of Your Daily Bread Company, which offers nutritional advice, which it claims is rooted in biblical wisdom and Christian principles.
People are ready. They have tried every diet under the sun. So by the time they see my page, what I see is, oh my gosh, I didn't know what I was missing. I never even considered to bring my faith into it. But Jesus says in John 15 that apart from him, we can do nothing. So as a registered dietitian, I provide everything that a registered dietitian is licensed to do. We call that medical nutrition therapy. As a Christian dietitian, there's an extra layer and pointing them to scripture. And I let God do his thing. They're not striving for the weight loss anymore. They've surrendered that. And then they start to lose the weight. A couple scriptures come to mind. First is John 21 verses 1 through 14, where Jesus eats breakfast. And a lot of people are resistant to eating breakfast. And one thing for me to tell them as a dietitian, hey, you need to eat breakfast and we need to balance breakfast. It's a whole other thing. Be like, oh, Jesus ate breakfast. He had bread and fish. He had carbs and protein. They want to model how Jesus ate. So scripture is showing what science proves. In addition, I always bring people to Luke 9, verses 14 through 17, where Jesus feeds the 5,000. Again, that's another balanced meal with the bread and fish, but it's our recipe for how we approach mealtimes. Jesus said to the disciples, okay, get everyone in groups of about 50 each and have everyone sit down. Then Jesus breaks the bread. He prays over the meal. And I encourage my clients, pray over your relationship with food. Lord, help me to be sensitive to my body's fullness cues and give me the self-control and the strength to stop eating when I'm satisfied.
Abby Stasia there. Nathan MacDonald is Professor of the Interpretation of the Old Testament at Cambridge University, the author of two books on food in biblical times, which will be very useful to us. Welcome, Nathan. Good morning to you. Are you surprised to see this sort of biblical diets having a moment?
Not really. Biblical diets have been a long-standing feature of American fundamentalism and some of the fringes of evangelicalism. So if you go back to the 2000s, you have the Maker's Diet, you have Don Colbert's What Would Jesus Eat, which is a play on What Would Jesus Do. Goes back even further than that, to the 1970s, with some titles that make my hair stand on end. So C.S. Lovett's Help, Lord, the Devil Wants Me Fat, or Joan Kavanagh's More of Jesus, Less of Me, or even Patricia Cremie's Slim for Him.
Yeah, you can make your own up, couldn't you? How to Be a Firm Believer. It just keeps going on, doesn't it? What about biblical diets as a concept? What people actually ate in biblical times? Some of this might be a bit of mythology. Some of it might be rooted in actual evidence. What can we say for sure?
Well, we shouldn't imagine that every food mentioned in the Bible is part of a sort of broad menu from which Israelites chose.
Right.
For most, Israelites' diet was mostly based on grains, bread and porridges, legumes. Most people had very little meat in their diet. Israelites seem to have had a high view of fruits, grapes, pomegranates, but they did have a fairly low view on vegetables. So their ideas of diet were not necessarily akin to ours. And there is some evidence from skeletal remains discovered in Israel that there is evidence of malnutrition and of vitamin deficiency.
Right. So that's not exactly an endorsement. And let's just be clear, Nathan, Jesus was not a nutritionist. The Bible is not a diet manual.
No, it isn't. But various parts of the Bible do talk about food. And you mentioned the story of Daniel, of how Daniel and his friends are deported to Babylon and they are made to serve in Nebuchadnezzar's court. And there they refuse the court food and eat a simple diet of vegetables. And after 10 days, the story tells us they looked visibly healthier. But that's not really diet. It's not really dietary advice in
our
modern sense.
That's supposed to be a miracle, really, wasn't it?
Well, it is, and it's meant to communicate the superiority of Jewish religious practices
right.
and beliefs.
It's making a theological, cultural point rather than a dietary point.
Well, indeed.
Do you think this trend is likely to catch on in the UK?
I don't think so. This is a long-standing feature of American religiosity. You can trace its. I mean, you can see it already in the 19th century with Ellen White, the co-founder of Seventh-day Adventists, who writes books that are still very influential within Seventh-day Adventism on vegetarian diet. And what's sitting behind this often is 19th century New Thought, which is the idea that the body is a mirror onto the soul.
Right.
And that the mind can affect the body through positive thinking. So the body often reveals spiritual health in this view. So, for example, many of these biblical diets do imagine having a good body to be a positive witness for Jesus. You right. can see somebody looking very healthy, and therefore they ask you, well, tell me about this Christian gospel. Why do you look so well? But also there needs to be an alignment of body and soul in these diets.
Thank you very much, Nathan MacDonald from Cambridge. The United the Kingdom rally, organised by the far-right activist Tommy Robinson, drew some 60,000 people through London earlier this month. Among them were wooden crosses, chants of Christ is King, and Christians with sometimes very different reasons for being there. But the rally itself has ignited a debate about the apparent rise of Christian nationalism in the United Kingdom. New research from the religion think tank Theos finds that 17% of British adults believe you need to be a Christian to be genuinely British. 41% say British law should be based on Christian values. The Reverend Luke Dobson is a Church of England priest who walked in that march alongside other pastors. Tommy Sharp is founder of the grassroots organisation Better Story, who set up a listening corner on the day to understand what drew the supporters to the event. And they both told me what they saw and what they heard.
As I was there, I interacted with quite a lot of people, prayed with some people. I found there was a real openness to the gospel. As a Christian minister, that was overjoy. There was a real hunger to get back to our Christian roots as a nation.
Tommy, what was your experience?
For me, it was a day of two halves. And in some ways, I agree with Luke's assessment. I think I went and chatted to people and had a few long conversations on the day. And there were people experiencing real grief about the state of the country and feeling very angry and like they weren't being listened to. On the other hand, I found some of the things that were being platformed on stage really quite troubling as a Christian. The theatrical Islamophobia with people wearing niqabs and taking them off on stage or putting bacon on their shirts on the stage to ward off Muslims was, I think, a phrase that I heard in the crowd. So I found the discrepancy of some of the individual conversations I had and what was platformed on stage.
Luke, did you see any of that kind of thing?
I totally understand what was just said, and I did see some of that. Clearly, it was thousands of people. There was a diverse group of people that had different views. Some of what was on stage, I would have felt that came into quite theatre. So you have to sort of then interpret it through that lens.
Did anything cross the line for you?
Not that I saw. I was talking to the people in the crowd more than I was watching on stage. So if there was something really offensive, then chances are I probably missed it.
Tommy, did this feel like a Christian nationalist event to you?
In many ways, yes. I think some of the conversations I had with individuals, as Luke said, were people who were seeking God. On the other hand, I do think there was a level of co-option of the Christian faith that I was seeing, particularly on stage, to justify a nationalist ideology that has very little to do with Jesus.
And we recall what Rowan Williams and some other church leaders said following the previous Unite the Kingdom rally, Luke, when they signed an open letter describing the co-opting and corrupting of the Christian faith to exclude others and saying it was unacceptable. And the Archbishop of Canterbury, Sarah Mullally, in the House of Lords more recently, warning about religious identity and symbols being, quote, misused to intimidate and divide. Do you think they have a point, or are they missing the point?
I respectfully completely disagree. I think the thing that we are missing in this narrative is we've still got the vestiges of Christian iconography, and that points to our Christian heritage. So on the day, I didn't see any form of racism. And I think there is sort of a misunderstanding of what's going on at the event. People are looking to connect their story and connect their identity back to a Christian heritage and to a nation turning back to God. In our iconography, in our crown, we have the cross on top of it. That means that we are a nation that seeks to put the cross of Christ at the centre of all we do. And the kingdom of God is open to all races, all people, but it is a Christian kingdom. So any ideology that seeks to set itself up to that, yes, it should be pulled down and it should be addressed.
I feel this conflict of the use of Christian symbols doesn't necessarily mean that something aligns with who Jesus is. And we're told by Jesus himself that we will know a tree by its fruit, and the fruit of the Spirit is love and joy and peace and patience and kindness. And so if something doesn't have that, it raises alarm bells.
How do you feel as you hear that, Luke?
It really is a difference on theology, basically, looking at Scripture. But we've just had the Feast of Ascension and the Feast of Pentecost, and that is all about Christ ascending to the highest point of the universe. He is the Lord of all, he's the King of Kings. And Pentecost is about his conquest, going out into the world to make the kingdoms of this world the kingdoms of our God. So it's all about conquest. The question becomes a thing of discipleship. On it's how do we conquest? Well, we do that by modelling Jesus's sacrificial, self-other-oriented reign. But if we make that the gospel of nice, it can be then reflected of we just need to be nice to people, as opposed to actually the Christian message is a message of truth and grace.
Tommy, I wonder how much of this is theological. You can't agree with him, I know, on what Christ the King necessarily means. Do you think you can agree even on what the gospel message and its implications means?
I think Luke's right that it is a difference of theology and an understanding of who God is. Jesus came on a donkey, not a chariot, and is a very different kind of kingdom, an upside down kingdom where weakness is strength rather than strength and power being the thing that is the yardstick of the gospel. So I think it is ultimately a theological difference that can I have.
I do believe that Jesus is Lord of all. He said, all authority in heaven and earth has been given to me. He says at Pentecost, receive power from on high to be my witnesses. So we need to acknowledge that Jesus is about power and authority, but it's the way he exercises it is through sacrifice, through love. And I totally agree with that. We just need to get a bit of balance. I feel like the gospel of nice is just one half of the gospel. It's his throne is the righteousness and justice is the foundation of his throne. He comes full of grace and truth. I do believe that it's a God of love, but he's also come to bring a sword, not literally, but he does bring division by his word. So he does separate those who want to follow him, those who don't want to follow him.
I guess for me, in some ways, the teachings of Jesus are deeply complicated. In some ways, they're quite simple. He gives us two commands, takes all of the Old Testament law and summarizes it in two commands, being to love God and to love our neighbors. And when he's asked, who is my neighbor? He specifically describes someone who is other, someone of another faith, the Samaritan, as the one who is merciful and neighborly. And so the kingdom of God that I know is one that can accommodate difference in love and yes, lead people to Jesus, but through love and sacrifice, not through power and authority. And I think that's a very, very different kind of kingdom.
Tommy Sharp there, and before him, the Reverend Luke Dobson. It's 7:34. Still to come this morning, what can faith communities do to support our growing population of NEETs, that is, young people not in employment, education or training? Have you ever heard of Wit Walks? These are processions held after Pentecost. And if you grew up in Greater Manchester, actually, there's a very good chance that you'll know exactly what they are. In much of the country, they have faded away. But in Saddleworth, near Oldham, they are very much alive. Thousands turned out on Friday. And the village also hosts one of the most celebrated brass band competitions in the world.
I've always lived in Greenfields, it's always been a local tradition. Really enjoy the atmosphere, especially when the sun's out, makes it all worthwhile. Yeah, very enjoyable.
We came here about 40 years ago and we thought, wow, well, this is really strange. Coming from Knotty Ash in Liverpool, we thought it was very strange, all these brass bands going around. But now we entered into the tradition. And our daughter, since she's been 7 years old, she's been with Dobcross Youth Band and she's come up through the ranks. And she's playing here today with the Dobcross Monkeys.
I just think it's a great atmosphere from the church walks in the morning. It's the bringing together of the people in the churches, all the children, adults, everything. It's just a fantastic atmosphere.
The sounds there of Saddleworth's brass bands. And Dr. Louise Platt is a reader in place experience at Manchester Metropolitan University. She has studied the origins and significance of the Wit Walks.
There's been kind of walking within churches for a long time, like rogation and beating the bounds, but the Wit Walks in Manchester specifically started in around 1801. I mean, it grew out of the Sunday school movement in the city where the factory worker children would have had an education. So this was kind of a procession of the Church of England through the city between the churches, and it just grew from there, really. And it's been happening in the city now for over 200 years.
At its height, how big did this get?
So by the late 1800s, there was around 15,000 Sunday school children and clergy taking part. And then by 1936, it's reported there was around 30,000 children, growing to about 40,000 in the 1950s. You know, and that's not accounting for spectators. So it was a really popular day.
Louise, how come it went into such significant decline?
So in 1967, the spring bank holiday was fixed. So in the 1960s, Manchester Chamber of Commerce were quite, they complained about the Whit Walks, that they were paralysing businesses. And they wanted the Catholics who walked on a Friday and the Church of England who walked on a Monday to join together to try and ease that. But by the late 1960s, there was real concerns whether it would continue.
And yet the tradition has held on in Saddleworth. How come?
I think in some of the towns, you know, surrounding Manchester, smaller places, maybe much easier in terms of navigating through those streets. I mean, obviously, road closures, it costs these organisations money, but it's maybe a little bit easier in some of the smaller villages than it is in the city centres.
Of course, you've got the brass bands as well.
The brass bands have always been an important feature, but not always uncontroversial. So in 1905, there's a great letter to the editor that says, "We have gone quite mad for brass bands." You know, so this kind of plea for just religious music. So a real mix of opinions on that.
I guess in some ways you could look at these Whit Walk traditions as indicative of changes in society, you know, industrialisation, deindustrialisation.
Yes, it's about religion, the Whit Walks. It's a procession of witness, but it's about place identity. It's about community identity. And, you know, some of these communities have seen real change. Manchester city centre has seen real change. There was a huge depopulation of the city centre, which is now growing again. The factories closed, deindustrialisation and so-called post-industrialisation, competing for people's leisure times. So you can really chart those kind of changing leisure practices of the city through these Whit Walks.
And what about those who go along to these Whit Walks?
You know, it's really important to them. It's about their community identity. It's quite often about their family heritage. They did it with their grandparents. Now they do it with their grandchildren. There's a real kind of intergenerational aspect to it. And I've seen people in the crowds kind of a little tear rolling down their cheek, really evocative of, you know, a time gone by, I suppose, but it is still happening. It's happening every year.
Our thanks there to Dr. Louise Platt. And we have a special bonus for you as well. You can hear more from Saddleworth's Whit Friday celebrations on Sunday worship at 8:10 this morning. When the time comes, most of us in the UK face a choice between two options for what happens to our bodies, burial or cremation. But there's a growing campaign to make another option available in England and Wales, and that is human composting. That's where the body is placed in a vessel with organic material, and over several weeks it becomes soil. The process is already legal in a number of American states, and last year the Law Commission launched a consultation on whether new funeral methods should also be regulated. But what about human composting? It's an option in the state of Washington in the United States, and the one that Thomas Axmacher's late wife Suzanne chose, as he here describes.
She passed away in April last year. She's now resting under a beautiful oak tree on a farm from our friends in outside of Dallas. It was very different than normal burials and funerals. The ceremony we had at the farm was very informal. We had our friends there and family helped to put the soil under the tree, and we played her favorite music. And it was very relaxing. So then I decided when I will pass, I will go through the same process in Seattle. And then my friends will put my soil on top of hers. So we will be together again forever. And it's actually all we can do after 52 years of being happily married. And that is why I think this concept is the best we can do as human beings or influence to do, to be together again, that the DNA is mixing and whatever else, it's in God's hands. We can control it. And we don't know what's afterwards. Unfortunately, that's the big surprise.
That is one person's choice in the United States. And amongst those pressing for change on this side of the Atlantic is Christopher Hughes, chief of the Anglesey Druid Order, who previously worked, actually, for 3 decades as a mortuary officer. Good morning, Christopher.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm doing very well. Tell me this. What has drawn you to this particular approach to a form of burial?
The amazing thing is, as after 32 years of working as a death service professional, I didn't think there was anything left to surprise me in that industry. But in 2024, I was presenting a Welsh language documentary for S4C looking at death in different cultures. And we went to the United States to look at human composting. And it completely blew my mind, not only to the fact that there could be another method, another choice, but also that we could initiate a brand new dialogue when it comes to talking about death.
It's also a dialogue with nature, I guess you could say as well. Is part of this your Druid culture or worldview being brought to bear?
I think so much of it did align with my Druidic faith and beliefs, yeah, particularly from an ecological perspective, and that enigmatic thought of returning to the cycles of nature in a way that not only honored my body as a vessel that carried the experience of my life, but to be able to give something of myself back as a gift to the planet that has nourished and fed me for my entire life. And that thought in itself eased all of any existential crises that, yeah, I may have carried through my career, through my own life.
Of course, some people will find this very poetic. Actually, Christopher, I get that. Other people will react with horror and say, you know, you're turning human beings into soil. How do you respond to people with that reaction?
I think there is a visceral reaction, especially when people hear the term human composting. It's like, well, what do you make of that? How do you understand that?
It's not a great phrase, is it, to be fair?
Yes, yes, exactly. But once you start actually talking about what that means to return to the earth in a way that honors the cycles of nature, I found that in our experience, the conversations turn very positive very quickly, particularly in younger demographics. And most people from the age of 16 to 35 rarely talk about their own mortalities. And we found that they're so willing to engage, maybe because they are more ecologically conscious than somebody like myself in my 50s who's had to learn that. So we've been having incredible conversations with ages from 16 all the way up to 99 about how this is something that not only is holistic and cathartic, but also ecologically sound as well.
Well,
it doesn't use any resources.
We already have woodland burials. We have natural burials. There's lots of options out there. I'm going to come back to this just in the last few seconds. I'm going to come back to this phrase, human composting, though, Christopher. If this were to be called human earthing, for example, it would have a very different response in the minds of some people, wouldn't it?
It does. That sounds actually really nice. Can we steal that?
Human earthing. I give it to you.
Thank you very much. That sounds lovely. Yeah, so the term that we're using in the United Kingdom is human organic transformation. They use the term natural organic reduction in the US, which we thought was a little clinical. So we're trying to change that vocabulary in the UK by referring it to as human organic transformation, which is exactly what's happening. And the term transformation is something that's never really been used in any conversation surrounding death, which is so final. And this is the antithesis of finality.
We will see.
Where it goes.
Christopher, I've got to break in, but thank you very much. Christopher Hughes. There is a risk of a lost generation in the UK unless urgent action is taken to make sure young people and more young people are either earning or learning. That is the warning coming from the government commissioned review published this past week, led by the former health secretary, Alan Milburn. It says the number of 16 to 24 year olds not in education, employment or training, also known as NEETs, could reach 1.25 million within the next 5 years alone. Some young people at BBC Radio 1's Big Weekend in Sunderland shared their thoughts on that with us.
I know all my friends have struggled getting jobs, and the jobs out of work, and it's like 4 o'clock and 3 o'clock in the morning that they're finishing it.
What happens on the surface is influenced by a lot of other factors, government tax money.
When they say fresh graduate, to actually consider the fact that they're fresh graduates instead of having 5-6 years experience and stuff like that. So it's okay to like get them in to start as an admin role or something, but it's not okay to just like keep them jobless just because of no experience. So that cycle is going to keep going on if you don't have somebody to like guide you throughout the way.
Well, the UK's various faith communities are, of course, often directly involved in youth work. So what can they say? What can they do to support our growing NEET population? Khaled Anis chairs the Islamic Society of Britain. Johnny Hedges is from Blank Canvas, a Christian organisation working with young people in the Redcar area on the Yorkshire coast. Welcome. Good morning to both of you.
Thank you. Good morning.
How do you, first of all, let's get a sense of how you explain this growing NEET population. It is a worrying development for any culture. Khaled, what's your explanation?
Well, I think in the report, it describes it as a perfect storm. I think getting onto that first rung, that first ladder, is proving to be very difficult. The opportunities are very low. And I think it is definitely multifaceted. And what we can see is that there's a definite reflection of disadvantage within those figures. And so I think it's that perfect storm that is present, which impacts employment, impacts education, and it literally has Britain losing out on the talent of a generation.
But what is it, Johnny? Is it a lack of opportunities that young people have, a lack of ambition or aspiration? How do you explain it?
I don't think it's a lack of aspiration or ambition. I think what we're seeing is that, well, the report didn't surprise us. It's what we're seeing week in, week out in Redcar. But what I think that we are seeing is a lack of, I don't know if the phrase joining the dots provides a full enough response, but I think even from an early age, before their teenage years, the report states, and we can see that there is going to be an impact, whether, as Khaled said, through deprivation. It goes much more beyond, I don't want to just say the word system, but we have an opportunity here to do something, but it needs to join all the dots up.
Well, Khaled, of course there must be some systemic and structural issues involved in all of this, like with everything else.
Sure,
but there must be some personal aspects of it too. Two individuals in the same area may have a very different experience of this crisis.
Gosh, of course they do. And it's a very multifaceted problem that is there. But I think, I think it's very difficult to put it down to the individual. Of course, as an individual, you make decisions. But coming back to the aspiration, I think your environment, your surroundings, your parents, your culture, your communities, I think all of these have seminal impacts on individuals. Mm. And I think what we've seen sometimes is there is a poverty of what I call a poverty of aspiration. There is a different outlook where individuals cannot see beyond a particular point. It's not a fault on them, but it's a product of their environment and their upbringing.
Do you see that too, Johnny?
I don't know whether I necessarily agree. We run Youth Club Safe Spaces every week, and about three, four weeks ago, we were with about 40 young people on an evening, and I asked the question. We were talking about aspirations. What do you want to be? And we went around the room, and people named, I want to be a doctor, I want to be a lawyer, I want to be a performer, I want to work for NASA, I want to be a youth worker. And the desire was there. And these were young people from some of the most deprived communities in the country. These weren't from, it was a real mixture of young people. I think the question that then we need to be asking is, well, how do we support that to happen? And I think if I then ask them, how do you think that might happen? I think they might have struggled.
Of course, it can make a big difference if you can see someone a bit like yourself from your own background making it in those areas. You know?
And that's what we found as well, actually, that young people, and we of course work with young British Muslims, that if they can see somebody who reflects themselves, who've achieved something, who can give some mentoring, some helping hand to them, it makes such a big difference.
It's almost like proof of concept in a way, isn't it?
It is.
Someone from my background did that. Wow, I didn't know that was possible. Yeah. Turns out it is. Let's just turn to the different kinds of youth work and interventions that may be helpful. Some may not be helpful, but some more helpful. Tell us what you're up to, Johnny. I'm particularly interested in your Youth and Families Advocacy Program, YAFA, which is on your website, and it talks about these kinds of mentoring interventions. Is that working?
Yes, what we're seeing is young people are having situations turned around, and it's looking at not just the young person, but speaking with the family, having a relationship with school. And we simply come in and say, hey, we believe in you. We think that you can achieve. We think that we can see a turnaround. And we see young people who are on the risk of exclusion for attendance. We say, give us to the school, give us another term to work with this young person. And we're setting small goals week on week. And it is relationship. It comes from that larger gathering and then seeing them every week to saying, actually, could we see you every week but one-to-one and give them that time to be listened to?
And that's a collaboration. You're getting referrals from the schools as well?
Yeah, schools and just from families who are coming to us from the community and say, hey, actually, my child, my young person needs that support.
Yeah. Khaled, what do you think works and what doesn't work in terms of intervention?
Where we work is really with young British Muslims developing their critical thinking, their awareness, their soft skills, their leadership skills, and then critically allowing them to put that into action. So it's not just teaching these as skills, but it's then building on those so those skills actually become transferable into careers and into life. And then when you back that up with mentoring and with, you know, giving them reflections of themselves and people who've been successful, I think that really does impact them positively.
But here's the problem, guys. Churches and other faith groups like the Islamic communities in Britain have been working on this for decades, a long time, with youth interventions. And yet these neat numbers are going up, Johnny. It's clearly not working.
The report has a lot of statistics and, you know, they point to a specific direction. But I think we lose something of the story of the individual when we look at the broader picture, which is a really valid one. But actually, those individual moments that faith communities across the country are working each day, story by story, young person by young person, is such a key thing to remember and hold on to in all of this.
Khaled, I'll give you 10 seconds. Go ahead.
Thank you. So I think faith communities are undervalued. But however, my challenge to faith communities is to reach out to others, maybe of other faith groups in their local communities, and to build bridges and to help everybody together.
Yeah, work together. Yeah. Thank you very much, Khaled Anis and Johnny Hedges. That's your lot for this Sunday. You can, of course, get in touch with us by email, sunday@bbc.co.uk. See you again next week. Enjoy the rest of your Sunday.
Sunday was produced by Alexa Good and Katie Booth. Now the broadcaster, Joe Wiley, makes this week's Radio 4 appeal on behalf of carers worldwide.
I was 3 when my sister Frances was born with Crigu-Chagas syndrome, a genetic condition that causes significant disabilities. Growing up with her has brought highs and lows that are unique and difficult for others to understand. Even as a child, I felt a great responsibility to care for her, and I still do. It's a feeling shared by 25-year-old Mukta, who lives in a village in Bangladesh with her brother Al-Amin, who was born with spina bifida. Mukta's father worked long hours and her mother struggled to come to terms with his disability. So throughout their childhood, Mukta played a big part in caring for her little brother, washing and dressing him and carrying him everywhere because he couldn't walk. When he wasn't accepted into school because of his disability, Mukta spent hours teaching him how to read and write, often missing school herself to look after him. But with this responsibility came anxiety for Mukta. What would happen to Al-Amin when he grew up? Who would look after him when her parents were gone? And she wanted to build her own life. Her friends didn't understand and she felt very isolated. Then 4 years ago, she started meeting with others who also care for a disabled relative. For the first time, she found herself with people who understood. Brought together by a carers worldwide partner organisation, Mukta and the other carers gather under a tree in the village once a month. They enjoy tea and each other's homemade samosas and share the highs and lows of being a carer. There is also practical support like counselling and access to healthcare. Mukta even accessed a loan through the group to start a small chicken-rearing business with Al-Amin. This now earns him a regular income and status in their community. Mukta has been able to return to education and is studying economics. Thanks to the group, she has found a way to balance caring for her brother with her own needs. Carers Worldwide run support groups like this across Bangladesh, India and Nepal, countries where there is little recognition or support for unpaid family carers. The group Mukta attends costs around £40 a year to run. Anything you can give today will help. and a foundation which supports carers worldwide will match donations to a total of £2,500. To donate, just search online for BBC Radio 4 Appeal or call 0800 404 8144. Or you can write a cheque to carers worldwide and send it to Free Post, BBC Radio 4 Appeal. That's the whole address. And importantly, please mark the back of the envelope, Carers Worldwide. On behalf of Mukta and carers like her, thank you.
Joe Wiley, that number again to call, it's 0800 404 8144. The calls are free from landlines and also from mobiles. And you can find all the details for giving online if you search for BBC Radio 4 Appeal. Remember, if you are a UK taxpayer and if you want carers worldwide to collect the gift aid on your donation, please include an email or postal address so they can send you a gift aid declaration. Let's get a weather update now. Here's Elizabeth Rizzini.
Oh, thank you, Neil. Well, today is a day of sunny spells and some scattered showers. We've seen a slightly fresher feel to things this morning, with temperatures generally in the low teens in Celsius. For the Northern Isles today, plenty of frontal rain. That rain should clear by the time we get into the afternoon. For the rest of Scotland, sunny spells and some showers. The showers will be fairly frequent. Some of them can be heavy and even thundery through the afternoon, particularly across northern areas of Scotland. For England, Wales and for Northern Ireland, areas of cloud. We've seen plenty of cloud to start off the day across some southern counties of England into South Wales. There will be some bright and some sunny spells emerging. For high ground and coastal areas towards the west, there will be thicker cloud, maybe a bit of drizzle at times. And most of the showers across England and Wales will tend to be towards the west. They'll be fairly well scattered. The showers tending to fade away through the afternoon. And for some of us, especially across southeast England and East Anglia, it could stay largely dry for much of the day. Gentle southwesterly winds. It's cooler than it was on Saturday. For Scotland and for Northern Ireland, temperatures will peak in the mid to the high teens in Celsius. For England and Wales, the high teens to the low 20s, maybe 23 or 24 Celsius in southeast England and East Anglia. That's a lot cooler than it has been. Parts of London saw 30 degrees Celsius, but certainly still above the seasonal average. Overnight tonight, it's a fairly quiet night of weather. Northern Ireland, Scotland, seeing some more showers. Elsewhere, it's dry with clear skies for central and eastern areas, clouding over with some outbreaks of rain towards western coast by the time we get to dawn. Tomorrow, an area of low pressure and some weather fronts will bring spells of rain into the west first, all of that rain pushing eastwards throughout the course of the day. Temperatures high teens, low 20s.
All right, many thanks, Elizabeth Rizzini. Simon Jack presents this morning's Broadcasting House at 9, and here he is now. Good morning, Simon.
Good morning, Neil. Do you remember seeing that spectacular explosion of a rocket on the launch pad this week? A reminder of the risks of space travel as we count down to the launch of Elon Musk's SpaceX on the stock market in June. We're going to look at the ethics and the economics of privatising space. We immerse ourselves in the changing faces of David Bowie at an immersive exhibition of his sound and vision. Look at the art of essay writing after Sir Tony Blair got everyone at it. And our guys, the Sunday Papers, our best-selling historian Damon Lewis, outgoing Tate Gallery supremo Maria Balshaw, and TV legend Jan Ellis. That's BH with me at 9 o'clock after the news.
BBC News at 8 o'clock on Sunday the 31st of May. This is Charles Carroll. The headlines this morning. There are hundreds of arrests in France as football supporters clash with police after the Champions League final. Reports in the United States say President Trump has hardened the terms of a possible deal to end the war with Iran. And Nicola Sturgeon tells the BBC she feels like she's serving a sentence following her husband's conviction for embezzling party funds. French police have arrested more than 400 people across the country after violence broke out during Paris Saint-Germain's Champions League final against Arsenal. The majority of the arrests were in Paris. The French Interior Minister, Laurent Nunez, has called the unrest unacceptable after 7 police officers were injured. Our Paris correspondent, James Waterhouse, has sent this report.
From the moment Arsenal missed the penalty to hand PSG the Champions League trophy, fireworks started exploding throughout central Paris. However, after accusations of being caught off guard last year when 2 people died after the team also won, the police presence this time was muscular. 22,000 officers were deployed across France, with 8,000 in Paris. Several businesses were damaged, say police. We saw one shop being looted as fans, mostly teenagers, poured into the capital streets. Tear gas was occasionally deployed, but the scenes were mostly of genuine celebration. A parade involving the players will take place later this afternoon in front of the Eiffel Tower.
Israel's military says that it's expanding its ground campaign against Hezbollah into more parts of southern Lebanon. Airstrikes have been carried out north of the Litani River, which has previously been the northern boundary of Israel's offensive. IDF said that one soldier had been killed in a drone attack by Hezbollah. And as the war in Lebanon intensifies, US media is reporting that President Trump has made amendments to the latest draft of a possible preliminary deal with Iran. From Jerusalem, here's our correspondent Sebastian Usher.
After anticipation once again rose in the past couple of days that a deal between the US and Iran was about to be closed, the latest reports in the US media suggest that momentum has once again ebbed. Official sources have told reporters that President Trump has hardened the terms of the agreement from the US side, and a new framework has now been sent back to Iran. That suggests there could be days or even weeks of more negotiations before a final decision is made by either side to sign up to any deal. In the vacuum, Israel and Hezbollah have continued to descend into deeper conflict. The Israeli military has just said that it's expanding its ground operations in South Lebanon to new areas beyond the Litani River, while in northern Israel, temporary restrictions have been brought in for communities there as Hezbollah redoubles its cross-border rocket attacks.
Health officials in Brazil say they've identified a suspected case of Ebola. If confirmed, it would be the first infection outside Africa since the current outbreak began in the Democratic Republic of Congo. The man, who's in his 30s, had recently returned from a trip to the DRC. He's been kept in isolation. The former First Minister of Scotland, Nicola Sturgeon, has told the BBC she feels that she's serving a sentence for a crime she didn't commit. In her first media interview since her estranged husband, Peter Murrell, pleaded guilty to embezzling £400,000 from the SNP, the party she led for years, Ms. Sturgeon refused to apologise for the scandal. She's been speaking to Sunday with Laura Koonsberg.
Nicola Sturgeon's pain and anger is clear. She was never charged by police after a long investigation into her party's finances, but she told me that she feels she's serving a sentence in public for crimes she didn't commit.
For my own sake, but you know, for the sake of people out there, a lot of women who end up finding themselves blamed for the actions of the men in their lives, I'm not going to contribute to that kind of sense that I am responsible for somebody else's crimes. I will take responsibility for the things I do, the decisions I make. I'm sitting here with you right now answering questions because I believe strongly in that accountability.
As the SNP's leader, she shared responsibility for monitoring the party's finances. But the former First Minister was defiant that she knew nothing and would not apologise for the scandal. Despite her reputation as a tough and fearsome leader, she held back tears, recalling gifts her husband had given her that turned out to have been bought with stolen money.
And you can hear more of that interview on Sunday with Laura Koonsberg on BBC One or the iPlayer from 9 o'clock this morning. The operator of Southern, Thameslink and Great Northern rail services enters public ownership today as part of the government's plans to renationalise the rail network. The Department for Transport says that 8 out of 10 passenger journeys will now be on publicly owned services to be run eventually by the new body, Great British Railways. Here's our transport correspondent, Katie Austin.
The Labour government is carrying on with its programme of nationalising England-based train operators that hadn't already been taken into public hands under the Conservatives. It's doing this as the contracts of private companies expire. Nationalisation has not in itself necessarily proved a panacea in previous years, but ministers argue it provides an opportunity to tackle the issues people want, and that creating Great British Railways to manage both the tracks and trains will bring lasting change.
The Metropolitan Police says that 5 armed protection officers at Kensington Palace have been told to consider their actions after complaints about their conduct. The Sun newspaper says a female member of staff raised concerns about misogynistic behaviour, leading to the removal of the officers' passes. Scotland Yard said that it had carried out an investigation and the officers' behaviour fell below the standards expected. Millions of Colombians will head to the polls today to elect a new president following weeks of escalating political violence, guerrilla attacks and kidnappings. The current left-wing president, Gustavo Petro, cannot seek re-election, but the vote is still being seen as a key test of his policies. Here's our South America correspondent, Ione Wells.
10 years ago, Colombia's government signed an historic peace deal with the armed guerrilla group FARC. Since then, any progress towards ending the country's armed conflict has largely collapsed, with the Red Cross saying that the humanitarian toll reached its worst level in a decade last year. This election is not just a choice between left and right-wing candidates, but also between different visions of how to tackle the violence, much of which is driven by rival armed groups competing over cocaine smuggling routes and other illegal trades. The left-wing senator, Iván Cepeda, who's leading in the polls, designed much of President Petro's strategy on negotiating with these armed groups, which many security experts say has failed. His two main rivals include the far-right lawyer, Abelardo de la Espriella, and the conservative senator, Paloma Valencia. Both have pledged a tougher military crackdown on crime, including more cooperation with the United States.
Marsha Lucas, the Oscar-winning editor of the original Star Wars films, has died in California at the age of 80. She was married to the creator of Star Wars, George Lucas, during the making of the first trilogy and was regarded as a pivotal creative force. Helena Burke looks back at her life and career. No!
This is the moment Obi-Wan Kenobi is killed by Darth Vader in the first Star Wars film. If it wasn't for Marsha Lucas, it may have never happened. She is credited with convincing the film's director George Lucas to take the bold step of killing off one of the main characters. This is one of many edits made by Marsha to the first three Star Wars movies, adding emotional depth and narrative clarity to the films. But her success wasn't limited to the Star Wars franchise.
Talking to me? Well, I'm the only one here.
Marsha also collaborated with the director Martin Scorsese on a string of his acclaimed films, including Taxi Driver, Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore, and New York, New York. In a statement, her family described her as a true trailblazer for women in film and one of the most influential editors in cinematic history.
Well, that's the news this morning. Now a look at the Sunday papers. And the Sunday Mirror says the Technology Secretary, Liz Kendall, has given the strongest hint yet that a social media ban for under-16s could be introduced within weeks. She's told the paper that 9 out of 10 parents who responded to a government consultation called for tougher age limits. Ms. Kendall is quoted as saying, "A ban is definitely on the table." The Sunday Express says food and drink manufacturers have warned a soon-to-be-announced trade deal with the European Union would make rising prices at the checkouts worse. The Food and Drink Federation claims that while it would lower prices in the long run, costly short-term changes would be needed in order to line up with the new rules. A government spokesperson tells the Express its food and drink deal could bring more than £5 billion into the economy. The leader of the Conservatives, Kemi Badenoch, has written in the Sunday Telegraph to say that future party MPs will not be, as she puts it, glorified social workers. Ms. Badenoch says politics has become a stage when it needs to be a workshop. She adds that future candidate selection for her party will focus on the five C's: cleverness, charisma, communication skills, conviction and conservatism. And the Mail on Sunday says that a study in Toronto has found that a person's gender could dictate the dreams they have. Researchers questioned almost 300 men and women aged 18 to 80 and found that women mainly dream about family and relationships, while men turn to competition and risk. I'll look at the Sunday papers.
Many thanks, Charles Carroll. This is BBC Radio 4. It's 10 past 8. Time now for Sunday worship, which celebrates the Whit Friday traditions in the villages around Saddleworth.
I've always lived in Greenfields. It's always been a local tradition. Really enjoy the atmosphere, especially when the sun's out. Makes it all worthwhile. Yeah, very enjoyable.
There's not a thing about Whit Friday.
That's just the music and the beer. It's the best part about it.
We came here about 40 years ago and we thought, wow, well, this is really strange. Coming from Knotty Ash in Liverpool, we thought it was very strange, all these brass bands going around. But now we entered into the tradition. I think it's just the occasion, the socialising, the beer, and it's tradition.
I just think it's a great atmosphere. From the church walks in the morning, it's the bringing together of the people in the churches, all the children, adults, everything. It's just a fantastic atmosphere.
My name's Vernon Cressy. I'm one of the joint coordinators of the Whit Friday processions. We're in Dovecross Square at the moment, which is a very historic place. If we look round, we've got very old buildings here. The procession takes place, we all gather in the square, because it's the biggest place around, and we can have a proper service here. Basically, we have the brass bands walking from the band club, and we end up in this square with usually about 1,200 people. So you can imagine, as we stood in the square, that it's quite an atmosphere. From the outside of the Swan Pub, we have a little service which is led by the vicar. It only takes 20 minutes because we have to then start marching off and getting everybody in order to start processing down the lane. Then we walk to Upper Mill and join all the other processions for a service in the Upper Mill playing field. You've got church banners, you've got the colourful brass bands, you've got all the congregation and the supporters, all the families who support the band. But it's a wonderful occasion. And then we move on to the band contest. Well, Hill Smiling Morn is played quite a number of times because that's the traditional Whit Friday. It starts off in the band club, that one, then it's sung again on the way, and it's sung in Upper Mill. Well, it's really important from a Christian point of view. We're great believers, and it's the tradition again, because it started because of the churches going way, way back. We want to keep that going. And as Christians, it's very important that we let people know what we believe in and we give them the opportunity of joining in.
I'm Sue Crook. I am chairman of the Dovecross Youth Band and have been for 38 years. My association with Whit Friday goes back into my childhood and every year ever since, and these days now it is with supporting the band and the local church. I recently found a photograph of the Whit Friday 1948, and on it all the little girls are dressed in white. I'm right in the front, probably the smallest on the picture, with a beautiful white dress on, a big white bow in my hair, and the basket of flowers. When we were very young, we held a ribbon on the big basket filled with flowers carried by Sunday school teachers. And as you went through the years, getting older, and your attendance was good at Sunday school, you eventually graduated to holding a ribbon on the banner. The back of the banner first, and then when you moved onto the front of the banner and you were right in front of the procession, it was an absolutely wonderful feeling. 38 years ago, my father, who was chairman of the Dovecross Silver Band, said to me, "You know a lot of children in Dovecross, and it's time we started to grow our own bandsmen." So I got together a group of children, and we started with 6 kids. And the first Whit Friday, there was about 8 of them marched at the back of the Silver Band in the pouring rain, but they didn't give up. And it's a wonderful feeling, walking in front of the procession, feeling very, very proud of those children behind me when there can be 90, all dressed in red, playing the little hearts out. It's very profound in the morning. The service means a lot. The hymns, most of them know by heart because I've sung them for all my life. And it's a very uplifting occasion, even in the rain. But on a sunny day, of course, it's twice as uplifting. At the end of the day, whoever is the last band down onto the field is requested to play The Day Thou Gavest, Lord, is Ended. And as in all the contests, when the adjudicator blows his whistle, there's a silence that falls. But in Dob Cross, before they start the hymn, the silence is really profound and everybody sings. And it's just wonderful in the evening air.
I'm Godfrey Adams, local ordained minister within the Saddleworth team. Whit walks are a tradition that stem right back to the biblical account of the disciples that received the Holy Spirit and just couldn't contain themselves, and they went out onto the streets. Whit Friday or Whit Sunday are celebrations of the similar kind of witness, and it is us receiving the Holy Spirit and going out and sharing the good news with the members of the public. There are very similar traditions in Manchester and Tameside. In most of Saddleworth, we do our Whit walks on the Friday after Whit Sunday. The uniqueness of Saddleworth is that the Whit walks are driven by the congregations, not by any form of church hierarchy. The Holy Spirit is absolutely key to the whole success of the day. And it's the prayer and the dedication that helps form the basis of the love that translates through the whole of the day, the working together of the different denominations and the support that denominations give to each other. Witness is something really special in the sense that people can see that you're acting out what you believe. You're not just telling people or giving them a lecture or giving them a sermon. You're sharing who you are and what you believe. And that is what witness is about. And when we're thinking about witness, that is what we're doing on Whit Friday. The whole morning with the processions and the joint services, it is about witness and being able to share our faith with other people, and they can see what our faith is. And the witness continues into the evening with the way the band contests are carried out, with the friendship and the love and the support of the community to all the bands.
Clap your hands together, all you peoples, O sing to God with shouts of joy. For the Lord Most High is to be feared. He is the great King all over the earth.
He subdued the peoples under us and the nations under our feet. He has chosen our heritage for us, the pride of Jacob, whom he loves.
God has gone up with a merry noise, the Lord with the sound of the trumpet. O sing praises to God, sing praises. Sing praises to our King, sing praises.
For God is the King of all the earth. Sing praises with all your skill. God reigns over the nations. God has taken his seat upon his holy throne. The nobles of the people are gathered together with the people of the God of Abraham. For the powers of the earth belong to God, and he is very highly exalted.
I'm Bob Rogers. I'm chairman of the Delft Band Contest. I was chairman of the Central Committee until August last year.
I'm Mary Rogers. I go back further than him, but we jointly run the Delft Contest. I've been to every morning Whit Friday that there's been, so my mother told me. She said I was here at a few months old in 1947, and I don't think I've missed a year. So it's a long time.
I was born in Denshaw, which is about 4 miles away from Delft. And it was only when I started courting Mary that I realised Delft had a band contest of their own, you know. So I just got involved peripherally initially. And then we said, well, we would take it over and run it. So we've been running it since 1972. We're Friday morning, 9 o'clock sharp. It's Hail Smiling Morning down the street. We march through the village, come back to the band club. And then it's a church service over across the street. They alternate between St Thomas's and the Methodist Church. We work very closely with the two churches. The Methodist Church allow us their premises to set up our contest, which is outside the church. We've only got from 2 o'clock till 4 o'clock to get it all set up, so it is organised chaos. It goes back a lot further than when the first band contest was held. And the bands, there weren't many in this area, and they were predominantly reed bands. And after they'd been round the walk, they would do the usual hostelry refurbishment, if you know what I mean. And then they'd be challenging each other and saying, oh, well, we play better than you. Well, let's see how good you are. Come on, let's start it. And that's how the band contest started. And the first ones that were held in 1884, Upper Mill and Staley Bridge. Delft played at Staley Bridge, and they came third, possibly out of three, but nevertheless. And the adjudicator's comment was, played well when the wind was in the right direction. So we now get 80 bands in the village, and that equates to one every 6 minutes in the time from 4 till 12 o'clock. It's just constant brass bands, 8 hours.
The newer bands, they want the carnival atmosphere. Some of them are very good players, and when you hear them down the street, it sounds, to my generation, sounds very rowdy and not my sort of music. But when you hear a recording of how they've played for the adjudicators, some of them are very, very good and they're in the prize list. But some of them just come out for a drink. And they're all in silly fancy dress costumes, which we don't appreciate, but the crowd do. When the bands come in, it's lovely because a lot of them know us, and it's, oh, give us a hug. And my son was a player, so a lot of his mates are still around, and it's nice to see them, and they always come and say hello, and it is a good atmosphere, but it gets very, very busy, and it's quite hard work. It gets very tired, so...
He's buried up at Denshaw Churchyard, where the Denshaw Contest sets off from on the march down. And every year, the Marsden Band go to his grave and leave a tie. And we have to return it every year when Marsden win a prize at Delft.
We think about him all the time. You just remember the people you love, so you sort of wish he was still there. And I do think, oh, he'd have been ringing me up to see if it was time for Delft to come down and book in and that sort of thing.
And there's certain hymns that certainly bring a lump to your throat, you know.
You said breathe on me, breath of God.
Breathe on me, breath of God. It's just that... brings back memories.
My name's Phil Goodwin. I'm the conductor of Delft Band, and I came here in 1980 and still here, so that's quite a lot of Whit Fridays. When we get to the assemble at the top of the village and we hear the clock strike nine, and of course that's when the day starts, and we set off down the high street. And I look back, and it's absolutely fantastic, because I have my senior band, we have a youth band, a training band, and our tutors. Our tutors started around age 5, 6, and of course, as a conductor, I'm not supposed to have any favourites, but the tutors are my favourites. And I see them, many of them, it's their very first Whit Friday, and it's a great spectacle, and I feel really proud looking back, and that we're keeping this tradition going. There's a big tradition in bands of using hymns as a way of learning. We know hymns have a very set pattern, because they were designed for people who were non-musicians originally. And so there's a pattern that if people get lost, they know they can pick it up. And there's also a pattern so they can know when to breathe. The basis, you know, of brass playing is to have a good sound. And that really, again, comes as an extension of your voice. What does it sound like when you sing? Is that great sound? And we want to emulate that as we play. And so it's a great teaching and learning tool for us. And most bands will start a practice by playing hymn tunes, and it gets them together. They learn how to breathe together, how to start notes together, how to finish, how we balance the band, how we tune the band, and so on. And so it's a great tool for us. When I first came here, I didn't particularly like the morning. I just thought it was wrecking the players, because it's such a physical thing. And I think that's still very true. Anybody who knows Saddleworth, we don't have any flat bits. And so walking around with a tuba, which I'm a tuba player, it's a very, very physical thing. Now, the morning is so important. It's the opportunity for the church to take their service out to the people, especially for parishioners maybe who are poorly, and we can go and visit them. And also, when we come back into the village, that everyone can take part in that service. And when I see and hear people joining into some of those great hymns that we have, whether it be Maccabees or Shine, Jesus, Shine, and you see the joy, then that's why that morning is so important. I think for many people who are not local, they only think Whit Friday is about the band contests. But in actual fact, the day here is very important for us, because it starts with the church processions in the morning. And it was only later that the contest evolved out of that. And so it's important to make that difference between what is the church procession and what then becomes a sort of carnival, a big festival, I prefer to call it. When you do have success, and when you're part of that, it's a fantastic feeling for the local band here, Delft. When we come down the street and when we've played our contest, I think for many people, that experience is like playing the FA Cup at Wembley, and it's a terrific feeling, and it's very hard to put it into words, but I think everyone is so, no matter how tired they are, at that point they're lifted, and it's a fantastic feeling, and it gears them up for next year.
My name's Laura. I have 4 children at Dobcross School, 3 of which are in Dobcross Band, so our involvement in Whit Friday is typically centred around the band. We start at the band club on the Friday morning. We follow the march all the way down into Upper Mill, where we have the procession and the service, and then we march all the way back up again. It's an atmosphere that you can't really describe. When you're marching, there's obviously the hundreds of people that are marching with you, but then there's also people that line the streets as well and wave as you're passing. And there's something really nice about following the band and hearing the traditional sort of iconic tunes of Whit Friday, the true and trusty melodies that the bands play, and following them, and then ultimately following the church with the banners. It's just something really nice. Yeah, it's lovely. I love it when the band play True and Trusty and you're marching along to it. It almost gives you goosebumps the first time you hear it on that day. It's always a tune that whenever I hear it, I instantly think of walking the streets on a Whit Friday morning, whether it be sunny or rainy and everything in between. It's very linked for me. I think for us as a family, we've always encouraged our children to get involved in things, and they've always been drawn to the band. And now for our youngest one, who doesn't play the instrument, she has memories now of walking along And I think it's just a nice tradition to carry on. So they will experience it as a child like I did, and then hopefully they will do the same. In the evening when they do the band concerts, you know, they call it the biggest free concert. And it really is. It's just amazing to be able to sit in your home village and listen to bands that are just absolutely fantastic and that have come from abroad. You know, people will come here from different countries to perform as part of the band contest on Whit Friday. And that's really lovely, that. It's almost like a step back moment and realise how lucky we are to be able to do that and experience it.
A reading from 1 Corinthians 15. Look, I will tell you a mystery. We will not all die, but we will all be changed in a moment, in the twinkling of an eye, at the last trumpet. For the trumpet will sound, and the dead will be raised imperishable, and we will be changed. For this perishable body must put on imperishability, and this mortal body must put on immortality. When this perishable body puts on imperishability, and this mortal body puts on immortality, then the saying that is written will be fulfilled. Death has been swallowed up in victory. Where, O death, is your victory? Where, O death, is your sting? The sting of death is sin, and the power of sin is the law. But thanks be to God, who gives us the victory through our Lord Jesus Christ.
My name is Reverend Sachin Savale, and currently I'm serving in Saddleworth Benefice as a team vicar. As a priest, I find Whit Friday one of the most joyful and moving days in village life. From early morning, you feel something special happening. Children are excited, banners are carried carefully, brass bands begin to gather, and people come out into the street. What stays with me most is seeing generations together, children, parents, grandparents sharing the same tradition. We begin with prayer and remembering Pentecost and the Christian roots of this tradition. But what I experience most deeply is togetherness. It reminds me of something at the heart of Jesus' message: love God and love your neighbor. And in many ways, you actually see that lived out. We live in a world where life can feel busy, divided, and sometimes lonely. Whit Friday brings people back together. It connects generations, villages, families, and communities. And it reminds us that traditions still matter because they help us belong. For me, it also quietly reflects the Christian message of hope, welcome, and love. When I first came here, Whit Friday was completely new to me. We don't have anything quite like this where I grew up in India. But over time, I come to love it because I see something very beautiful in it. Community, welcome, and belonging. I see children and families coming together, traditions being passed on, and villages taking pride in who they are. And as a priest, I also see something deeply Christian at the heart of it. The message of Jesus about love, hope, and caring for one another. And I enjoy every bit of it. And I feel welcome, and we feel part of it.
And now a prayer. May we be inspired by the eternal voice of the Father, the presence of Christ who walked upon earth, and the resounding song of the Spirit. May the light and love of the Trinity shine forth in our lives, and may our mouths be open to sing praise and glory to God.
We pray for our communities, near and far, and those strangers who are awaiting words of welcome. May we be united in love to build fellowship and friendship across the barriers of division. As we walk life's path, may we be guided by the light of faith, illuminating the darkness and dispelling fear and doubt, as we share the good news of Christ in word, deed, and song.
Heavenly Father, we thank you for brass instruments and the lungs and lips that blow them. Bless all who play in our bands and the communities they represent. May their music inspire us to live in deep harmony with one another and in rhythm with the abiding presence of Christ. Amen.
My name is Rosie Bannum. I live near the Saddleworth area, been here since 1993. I play in Delf Band, and I also go to Upper Mill Methodist Church. So I was born into a banding family. My dad, Norman Cree, was the conductor of Holroyd Band in Shipley near Bradford. My mum played in the band. Nearly all my family have played in bands or still play in bands. So I just grew up going to band practice, and as soon as I'd got my second teeth, I was learning to play, and our whole family life just revolved around band. So it's a great event for me because it's combining the band and the church together, and it's an opportunity to witness. The churches aren't very full normally, but you come to Whit Friday and everyone's there, whether they go to church or not, and they're taking it in and they're part of it, and it's a big community, and togetherness is what makes it all special. So the highlight for me is in Delft we play Shine Jesus Shine, and it's really jazzy, and it starts with cornet fanfare type, and it's got in the middle, it's got the euphoniums and the horns are doing glissandos up to high notes, and it's really lively. And at the end of it, even though it's just a hymn in the middle of a service, we get spontaneous applause. And to me, there's a line in there that is, fill this land with the Father's glory. And I just think of that when I'm playing it and think, there's lots of, you know, awful things in the world. Fill this land with the Father's glory. It gives me hope. Things can be better. So I really love the Whit Friday contests, going round on our coach, all these different places, and the reception you get, and the people you bump into that you know, and people we know in other bands are all there, and it's fantastic. But I think it's not all about the contests, won't quite be the same if we haven't done the morning first. The morning is what it's really about, and we're walking with the churches in the community. And then the Whit Friday night is like a party afterwards. So the highlight of Whit Friday night is when us as Delft band arrive in Delft Village. So it's like our homecoming. So then it'll be our turn, and the drummer will strike the drum as loud as possible, ready for us to set off. And as we start walking, the crowds down the side of the road see, oh, it's Delft band, and we're in our Delft purple jackets. And the word filter, Delft band, it's our band. And it's as if we've brought the FA Cup home, you know, and the buzz and the screams and shouts, and the crowd goes absolutely wild. And it's the best feeling ever. And you're playing with a smile on your face, and it's all the band, I'm sure, would say it's absolutely fantastic. And then you stop playing partway down the village, and you get this amazing cheer, and you're like, you feel like celebrities. It's wow, amazing, what an experience for everybody.
Thank you.
Finally, brothers and sisters, farewell. Be restored. Listen to my appeal. Agree with one another. Live in peace. And the God of love and peace will be with you. The grace of the Lord Jesus Christ, the love of God, and the communion of the Holy Spirit be with all of you. Amen.
Sunday worship featured Dobcross Youth Band, Saddleworth Musical Society, the choir of Holy Trinity Primary School, and Delph Band. It was a BBC Audio North production, and the producer was Catherine Longworth. Next week, Sunday worship comes from the Memorial Chapel of Glasgow University.
Two pizzas, 1 mile, 8 minutes.
7.90, except...
That was my first mistake.
Drama on BBC Radio 4.
Hello, your door is open.
When a delivery rider makes a shocking discovery.
Miss, can you hear me?
Oh no.
Oh no.
Can he escape what he saw?
Officers have confirmed the death has been formally ruled a suicide.
A new 5-part thriller.
You don't think she did it? I don't either. Find them.
The Courier begins next Friday at 2:15. To listen on your smart speaker, say play Radio 4.
Now history told by the people who were there. It's Witness History with Ben Henderson, who speaks to one of the most widely read Spanish language authors, Isabel Allende, about the book that made her name, The House of the Spirits. We start in Santiago in the 1940s.
My grandmother and three other women, they would sit around this very heavy oak table and call the spirits.
Isabel was born into a well-connected Chilean family in 1942, but her father abandoned them when she was young, so she was forced to move in with her unusual grandparents.
They were experimenting also with telepathy and trying to move objects without touching them. Telepathy was funny because the Morla sisters lived in the other end of the city, and they would send each other kitchen recipes telepathically. They never worked. Not because telepathy doesn't work, but because they were horrible cooks. But the legend is that my grandmother was magical. She instilled that in me, that there are many dimensions of reality, that the dead and the living walk side by side. My grandmother died very soon, and it became a house of mourning. My grandfather dressed in black from head to toe. He painted some of the furniture black, and there were no flowers, no music, no radio, no parties, no desserts. It was a sad place, but he was a very good storyteller. Spooky anecdotes about ghosts, that kind of stuff.
In her 20s, Isabel balanced motherhood with journalism. She presented a TV show and wrote for a feminist women's magazine, causing rows with her conservative grandfather. Her family was deeply political, and her father's cousin, the socialist Salvador Allende, was elected president in 1970.
I was young. I was in love with my husband. I had two little children. That was such a fantastic time in my life. The best, I would say.
But the country was hugely divided. Then, on the 11th of September, 1973, everything changed.
I got to my office. It was closed. And the janitor that was at the door said, "Go home, go home. It's a military coup." And what, a military coup? And so I went to a friend's house whose husband was a teacher in downtown Santiago. So I said, "I'm going to pick him up." And then when I got to the school, he was in one of the classrooms, and he was crying, and he was listening to the radio, to the last words of Salvador Allende.
Viva Chile, viva el pueblo, viva los trabajadores.
And then shortly after that, we saw the bombing of the palace from the school. We saw the planes coming, we heard the noise, we saw the smoke. And so we realized that something absolutely horrible was happening.
3 years ago, Dr. Salvador Allende was elected president of Chile. But Allende died in the blazing ruins of the presidential palace. Chilean democracy also died.
The military dictatorship led by General Augusto Pinochet rounded up those they regarded as left-wing extremists. Thousands were tortured and killed. Many tried to escape the country. Isabel allowed some of those fleeing the regime to hide in her house.
After some months of this, I realized that if any of those people would have been arrested and tortured, they would have had to say where they had been hiding, and I would be targeted. Then I found out I was in a list. So I lived in terror. I got a rash all over my body. I couldn't sleep. And so I left for Venezuela.
Isabel's hopes for a liberal, democratic Chile were gone. Her career was over. Her family was separated by exile. She tried to build a new life in Venezuela until eventually her past caught up with her.
In 1981, on January 8th, we received the news that my grandfather was dying in Chile, and I started a letter for him. The idea was to tell my grandfather that I remembered everything, that I remembered everything he had told me, his life, and that would not be forgotten. So it started with the first anecdote that I ever heard, which was the story of my great aunt Rosa, who was my grandfather's fiancée, and she died mysteriously right before the marriage. Apparently she was poisoned. We don't know if by accident or it was a crime, but they said that she was beautiful as a mermaid, and her photograph was always on the piano at home. So I started with the story of Rosa.
What began as a letter grew into a much bigger story.
I worked in a school, two shifts, 12 hours a day. So I would have the story evolving in my head all day. I would come home, have a shower to get rid of the school, and after dinner, lock myself in the kitchen. And while the family was watching TV, I was pouring out these anecdotes, really, these people that to me were not even connected. It was like one thing after the other, without a plan, without an idea of what I was doing or where I was going. And then somehow the story became also the story of the country. And so naturally, these pages ended in the military coup, which was the moment when my life really changed.
Isabel wrote every day for a year, by which time her letter had become a 500-page epic, tracking the lives of multiple generations of the fictional Trueba family, headed by the tyrannical Esteban and his wife Clara, who has supernatural abilities. The story is set in an unspecified country, but the descriptions, events, and characters evoke Chile's 20th century history.
The feeling was of joy, of freedom, of excitement. This creative force that took over me completely. My mother said at some point, I think this is a novel, and why don't we just take a chance? Let's send it to some publishers. She sent the book. We never got an answer. I never got a rejection letter, just silence. Until one day, a secretary called me and she said, I took your manuscript home and I really like it, but no one here is going to read it. You need an agent. I didn't know that agents existed for literature. I thought they were just for football or something. And so she gave me a name. I sent it to Carmen Balcells in Spain, and in a month, she called me back and she said, I'm going to have this book published. And that was the beginning of the miracle.
The House of the Spirits was published in 1982. It was an international bestseller.
And then I started receiving, by the end of the year, the first few checks. And I was amazed that somebody was going to pay me to write. Oh my Lord, I thought I had to pay.
But not everyone was happy with the book.
Although no one is mentioned by their names, some members of my family recognized themselves and they didn't like the depiction of the family. I tried to explain that it was fiction, but that didn't fly.
Some of her relatives didn't speak to her for years afterwards, but the animosity softened when The House of the Spirits was turned into a film in 1993, and Isabel's family saw themselves portrayed by Hollywood icons.
Jeremy Irons, Glenn Close, Vanessa Redgrave, you name them. They were all there.
Did that change your family's perspective on the book somewhat?
Yeah. Now it's the official story of the family. And Meryl Streep is my grandmother.
The House of the Spirits has sold more than 70 million copies in over 40 different languages. It made Isabel one of the most renowned novelists in Latin America's rich literary history.
It gave my life an expansion, a breath of air at a time when I was trapped. I felt that my life was going nowhere. My marriage was collapsing. My children were leaving for university. I was nobody. And then suddenly this thing happened. All that has happened in these last 40 years has been, wow, a gift from heaven.
Witness History was presented by Ben Henderson. For more memorable moments from history told by the people who were there, search for Witness History on BBC Sounds. Now, in Tweet of the Day, produced by Sophie Anton, the naturalist Mike Dulger describes his appreciation for the whimbrel.
Often denigrated as the poor relative of the charismatic curlew, the whimbrel, to my mind, has every bit as much star power. While curlews breed across the nation's moorlands, most whimbrel are transient, passing through each spring en route to their breeding grounds in Iceland, Scandinavia and Russia, before then reversing the journey back to Africa during the height of summer. Smaller than the curlew, a good view of a whimbrel's head should clearly show both a pale crown stripe and buff eyebrow, along with a shorter, straighter bill that only takes that distinctive downward curve towards the tip. Their calls, however, are a clear point of difference, with the whimbrel's rippling seven-note whistle contrasting with that of the onomatopoeic curlew. In spring, I can always winkle out a few whimbrel along the Severn estuary as they migrate north. But to see this wonderful wader at its best, you'll need to head to their solitary British breeding outpost up in Shetland. Here, territorial whimbrel